The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello and welcome to Moto POD, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 253 for Friday the 12th of November 2010. My name is Martin Darlington, I'm across in the UK, and with me as ever is Jim Race in California. Good morning slash evening, Jim, and how are you and your fosters?
We're doing quite well, thank you. I noticed you didn't trip over that, and I think I would have, and those of you out there that are lamenting the impending loss of the G, we have noticed and taken note. We actually have had some people who wanted to bid on it, but it's been pretty funny. We do have a great interview coming up this week. Those of you that have sort of been waiting, and that is amongst the many, with Mark Miller, his pre-Macau call, amongst others. And it is yet again another epically long interview. And Martin tried it in one sitting, couldn't quite make it through, but I think it's good, and I think you guys will enjoy it as well. We did have a whole bunch of listener emails and really enjoyed those this week. Certainly a lot of speculation and interest, not only, you know, not really so much as in the races over the weekend, but people looking forward and wondering what was going to occur with the testing. And it's been a wild week of testing that's almost kind of overshadowed for me the racing over the weekend, albeit great racing it was. You want to launch into some of these emails, Martin?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that Ross Kemmerly sent us a short but very insightful email, where, because we've been talking, you know, couldn't understand why Randy Depugne agreed to leave LCR and why LCR would want to change him, but he suggested that Randy might have happily gone to Pramac Ducati because he's going to expect the Rossi Burgess effect to trickle down to the satellite teams. And I thought, that's a good point, actually. Yeah.
And interestingly enough, it was a good point when he said it, and we'll talk about testing more in a bit. But coming out of the week's testing, well, you know, we won't even go there at this point, because what we'll probably do tonight is maybe breeze through the racing, touch on the high points, talk about the testing a fair amount, as much as we know, and then we'll probably just launch into the interview, because this is guaranteed to be a long show. But yeah, that was very cool from Ross, and it got me thinking as well. I don't think Randy necessarily agreed to leave. I think perhaps there was a they couldn't come to agreement on the amount of salary, and it's possible that San Carlo may have wanted somebody that fit more with their image, because they did re-sign, as we know. Actually, there were a whole bunch of re-signings this week. Repsol has also re-upped for a three-person team that will be including all three of the Honda factory Hondas, so that's kind of cool. Nick Codling. Wow. Yeah, Nick. I was amazed to hear from Nick.
Nick sent us another of his, I'm commuting to work on the Isle of Wight to Portsmouth ferry, and he made a very humorous suggestion that, you know, oh, loved the name check. That was probably in the hope of donation. He said, yeah, that's the only reason we ever do it. but he did make a very good case for why so much opprobrium, as I've put there, anger or almost hatred from some corners has been heaped on Lorenzo, as it was on Stoner in 2007. I mean, he was so glad to leave for the MotoGP to leave Donington, I think, because he used to get booed there. It's ridiculous. And Nick suggests that we've all been in love with Valentino and his flamboyant, charismatic persona for so long, we hate to admit his crown may be slipping. And I think there's a very good point there. And it's one of those things of acknowledging the fact that time moves on and waits for no man. A couple of points he made, though, that I did think. He described Ross's post-race celebrations as hilarious. Yes, I'd agree with that. And often self-deprecating and very funny. But he also said they're spontaneous. And I'd say, yeah, I think they're very, very meticulously planned. I think that goes without saying.
You don't think they have, like, you know, Snow White and Seven Dwarves around the track, you know, and
just happen to be wandering around? Yes. The Portaloo, you're never sure about that one. Did they put it there, or did he see it and think, I'll use that? I'm not sure. But and he also said he's humble in defeat. Well, fair play to Rossi. He will sit at the post-race conference, and he invariably will say, yep, so-and-so was really fast today. And he doesn't, you know, he rarely hides behind, you know, oh, it was because we had a wrong tyre choice, or he'll say we had some setup issues. But longer term, I think, I don't know, I think he's a master of undermining anyone who he sees as a threat. And we all remember he was good friends with Sete Gibernau. Sete got quick enough to start to challenge him, and that friendship fell apart. Marco Melandri, and there have been others, and we may well see Marco Simoncelli go the same way if he continues to ride as he did this weekend. And I think that one of Rossi's biggest problems at the moment is the current crop, particularly Lorenzo, and certainly far more these days Casey Stoner. They're less susceptible. They don't... Yes, they get wound up by him, and they get angry, but they don't lose control.
I think we'll have to see. I think we'll have to see. I think that... I don't know if I would necessarily say the crown is slipping. We all kind of forget that Rossi did have a fair bit of an accident in the middle of the season. Granted, Lorenzo was beating him before that, and it certainly would have made for a fascinating end of the season if his injury hadn't occurred. But I believe that one season does not a career end, and
I completely agree. I mean, we people said it in 06 and 07, didn't they?
Sure. The one thing we really have to watch for, of course, and will be fascinating, frankly, is the transition to the Ducati and what they can pull out from that machine and what magic may or may not be worked, what adaptations Valentino has to do to ride that bike, and it certainly will be a process.
I think one of the problems, though, is that because hindsight is such a wonderful thing, I remember when he went to Yamaha at the end of 03, beginning of 04, you know, lots of people said, well, that's that. And I thought, he's crazy. He's absolutely crazy. Now, it clearly was a genius move. Him and Jerry worked out exactly what they could get out of that bike, and they did, and they won the first race, and they won the first year's championship, and the second, you know, fantastic. But because of that, we almost expect him to do it again. Well, and it was a heck of a risk.
It was. It was. And there's no doubt this one is too. That being said, we did see some very interesting things coming out of this testing, which we'll hit on. And I'm kind of antsy to get to that part, so let's keep ripping through here.
Yeah, we had a really good email from Steve Schmidt, who is an American living in London. He works at a brewery. He is head of a brewery. And I thought, oh, that's handy. And he's managed to get his wife bitten by the major GP bug. They went to a couple of rounds this year, and they're looking for advice on visiting some races next year, namely Qatar, Aragon, and Le Mans. Now, I haven't been to any of those, so any listeners with ideas or contacts for, you know, particularly for Qatar, Aragon, Le Mans, do please email the show and we'll pass them on to Steve and broadcast them for everyone to benefit from. And I was thinking, oh, we could do a travelling to see MotoGP rounds off-season show with advice, anecdotes, and we could do the what would your dream round to go to be?
Not only that, but we could perhaps get some of our listeners that are seasoned travelers to these rounds on to give us some personalized advice. And in addition to that, if you have been to a circuit and you have intimate knowledge of it, especially if you've been a few times and really think you've got the place dialed and figured out, maybe what we can do is on maybe Facebook or ride on tour, wherever is easily accessible for most people. Would be to start a discussion about it so we can actually get it down in re-accessible print by everybody instead of hiding it away in a podcast somewhere. And seeing as how we're racking these things up as time goes on, I understand. One of the things we are going to do for the new site that I've been thinking about a lot lately is trying to get a little bit better search included beyond just the tag portion. So you can actually, and it is very important that we put together some good notes for the show so that you can dig these things up. But that's cool, and I think we'll definitely put that together.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing I was I know about, particularly Le Mans, was when we rode to Assen last year, we met some bikers on the Eurotunnel who normally went to Le Mans. It was their first year at Assen. And they did say, if you're going to camp there, don't expect too much sleep. It's very similar, apparently, to the 24-hour endurance race. The French just go there and party all weekend, which is great if you want to go and party all weekend.
Right.
But they did say you generally need to give yourself 24 hours after the race to recover to be fit enough to ride home if you're going on your bikes.
Yeah, you know, each track is a very individual and unique environment. You know, I could tell you pretty much anything you need to know about Laguna Seca, of course, having been there so many times, and a fair bit about Indy. And I think we've got people for most every track out there that can do the same for us. So we will we will pool the collective MotoGP POD knowledge and see if we can't set something up for as a service to you.
We've got in the news, basically, we've got the Valencia race to talk about, the Valencia test to talk about, and Lorenzo looks likely to run the number one on his bike next year, probably with a small 99 somewhere in the logo for marketing purposes, just as Nicky did with his 69 in 2007. And that's pretty much it. And anyone hoping for news on World Superbike, World Supersport, BSB, we're kind of a bit empty on that this week, so we'll wrap that up in a later show because we've got a lot to talk about.
We certainly do. And you know, an interesting thing about that team is with Lorenzo as the one and Ben Spies as the 1-1, it's kind of cool in a way. When I did watch today being Wednesday, the testing highlights, they had actually, thank you, MotoGP.com, you guys had a nice long, about 10-minute long highlight reel on that, and that was cool. And you got a pretty good idea and some pretty interesting changes and watching people come up to speed. So it is only 2 days, once again, and this is very early days. So let's zip through the racing, Martin. And we'll touch on highlights as we have them and they come to mind, and then we'll chat about testing.
Yeah, we started with the 125 race, and of course this was the only championship that was still open, although Marc Marquez was very much in pole position, if you'll forgive the pun, with, I think he went in with a 17-point lead on Nicholas Tirol. Paul Espargaro was out of the picture, and the race was... For a 125 race, it was slightly processional. I didn't watch it in great detail, and after all the testing, I'm struggling to remember, but Bradley Smith got out front and fairly comfortably led nearly all the race and won. And I'm trying to think if I think that's Bradley's first win of the season, isn't it?
It is, and at a good time for him. And certainly because this weekend it was also announced that he was going to be, it was a bit of a secret, was also going to be running for the Tech 3 Moto 2 squad next year. So was it this weekend or last? I think it was this weekend, wasn't it?
It was during the Valencia weekend.
Yeah.
I think it had been strongly hinted, and then Hervé Poncharal actually made the official announcement that he's going to have Bradley Smith and Mike D'Amelio. In fact, no, it must have been last week because we did mention it in last week's show. Moving swiftly on, Paul Espargaro was second, and he's also moving up to Moto2 next year, meeting his brother, who's moving down to Moto2, which will be interesting. Nico Tirol got the last podium place, but it wasn't enough, as Marc Marquez came in fourth and became world champion, and a thoroughly deserving one. To be fair, Nico Tirol would have been a deserving champion as well, but Marc Marquez has been phenomenal this season. Sandro Cortesi was fifth, Esteban Rabat sixth, Tomoyoshi Koyama seventh, Efren Vasquez eighth, Randy Krumanaka ninth, Luis Salom tenth, and on down the order. Taylor McKenzie For those who remember Neil McKenzie riding in BSB and MotoGP, mm-hmm. and he actually led a MotoGP at one stage, and against the likes of Schwantz and Rainey. Taylor McKenzie came in 21st on a wild card, and he is very much up and coming.
Yeah,
and if you listen to the British press, yeah, he's doing some interesting racing.
Yeah, and he was also doing it on a BSB pseudo spec RS125. So props to him for keeping it up and finishing the race. And yeah, you mentioned now McKenzie, and he is participating fairly well with the Young Riders Fund in bringing up and coming young riders through the UK system and beyond. So well done. I saw some pictures of him and through Honda Pro Racing, and I should probably post those up. I did put a bunch of pictures up of the testing onto Ride On 2 for those of you that would like to see those. So, but the 125 race was great. I, like you, have been visually and mentally poisoned by the testing from the racing. So I do remember it was a good race, and very much excited for Marquez, and that does make our Spanish triumvirate for all three classes. We thought it was going to come, and indeed it did. So well done, Mark. Very deserving champion.
And particularly in the 1-2-4, you look at the championship, the final results. Mar Marquez finished on 310 points, Nico Tirol 14 behind on 296, and then on down, but you got Spain, Pol Espargaró, Spain, Bradley Smith, Britain, Efren Vasquez, Spanish, Esteve Rabat, Spanish. I mean, they've dominated that class this season.
Sure.
And, yeah. And it'd be interesting to see how, because the Spanish series, I mean, this is where Bradley Smith came through, Danny Webb and Scott Redding all came through the Spanish 125 GP system. What happens with Moto3 and how they cross over to that when it comes?
It'll also be interesting to see what happens to those national feeder series when Moto3 becomes the sophomore, if you will, MotoGP class. What kind of changes they'll have to make, because these things are going to push on down the line a little bit. So we saw that when Moto2 became more than a concept, that was adopted as a class by the CEV, and that's the Spanish series. And so it'll be kind of weird. You know, there's a very serious trickle-down effect for those that are looking to make it to the top tier.
Yeah, although there's a note on BSB's website a couple of months ago now, I think, saying they may well keep running the 125 GP.
Right.
I'm not sure how tongue-in-cheek it was, because they said there's going to be a lot of 125 X125 GP bikes going cheap, because there won't be a role for them left in GP.
Indeed, there will be in some very, well, some very hot material, although kind of wonder how many of those bikes, if they will be coming out of the system. You know, these are bikes that were not cheap to lease, and, you know, we didn't see a whole mass exodus and leasing of the wonderful, you know, Aprilia RSAs into privateers' hands. So I wondered if the same thing will happen with all the Aprilias and rebadged derbies and whatnot down in into the national series. We'll have to see. I still think there's certainly a place for 125 GB bikes completely. I just kind of wonder if we'll also see four-stroke classes in the small displacement singles, if you will, for Moto3 type bikes. You know, we've already, Morawaki's been making a 250 GP type bike for what, 2, 3, 4 years now.
Yeah,
and they're probably very well suited to put this together. That's based on a dirt bike motor, but you know we're going to be seeing some interesting motors coming out with the flexibility that teams are going to have. So I'm looking forward to it.
Absolutely.
I mean, I am and I'm not. You know, I was okay with, after a while, I was okay with Moto2 coming around, but to lose the last two-stroke class in the GP series is a little bit painful, but I'm like, you know, nothing I can do. So
I'm much more encouraged having seen Moto2.
Yeah.
I'm much more encouraged that Moto3, they can make it work. What will be interesting is 3-4 years down the line, when we no longer have the 125 and 250s, which, you know, all the top guys say, you know, that's where you learn how to set a bike up. Will it become more difficult to identify those that are suited to move up to MotoGP through the lower classes when they go to the Moto3 and Moto2 system? Although Moto3, they're saying it won't be a control engine. They will allow.
That's what I'm saying. So, yeah, you're going to have some interesting power plants that aren't necessarily, reworked 250 singles that were originally intended for dirt bikes.
No.
And so purpose-built 250 singles. You might see some interesting stuff with a cap of 81 millimeters, which is the same as it's going to be for the thousands. You might see guys going to longer strokes or whatnot, trying to get a little bit. There are going to be some interesting things going on. It should be fun. Well done to Mark and the rest of the 125 crew. And, you know, I did want to say something about Moto 2. One of the reasons I'm better with it, because midway through this season, I was looking at Moto 2 and I'm like, you know, we were expecting at the beginning of every race a monumental crash in turn one or two. And it was coming true. But I have seen as the season's gone on and the riders have matured and realized that it's kind of important to actually finish a race if you want to get points and be there at the end, is people are – I was kind of amazed because I think Valencia may have been the first – not positive. It may have – We've had a couple of rounds near the end of the season where everybody made it through the first lap, and that if you think about the second, third, fourth race, I probably wouldn't have put money down on that at any point. So
no, and it got to the stage where Moody and Ryder were saying, "Where's the crash going to be in the pack?" Because they knew it would be somewhere.
Yeah.
I do remember, ironically and horribly ironically, was Misano was one of the first races where everyone got round the first lap okay. And then obviously we had the tragedy of Tomazawa later on in the race. But, I think you're right. They've certainly got to that stage of, you're not going to win the race in the first corner. Just apply a bit of caution.
Indeed. All right, let's zip along. Run us through Moto 2 here. And that Moto 2 was a great race.
It was a fantastic race. We had Stefan Bradl initially, fresh from his inaugural win last time out at Estoril. He was out front. Keenan Sofoglu was up there. We had Andrea Iannone, Julian Simon, the usual suspects. Tony Elias didn't start great but came through quite quickly. Scott Redding was up there, Alex De Angelis. And as the race progressed, I mean, the leader check just swapped so many times and that group were beating each other up. And then coming down that long Valencia straight into that really fast turn one, we had Bradl go past Keenan Sofoglu and quite brutally shut the door on him and moved across, leaving him nowhere to go. Now, Keenan could have backed off, tucked him behind, but Keenan being Keenan didn't want to, and he ran out of tarmac, ran off, crashed. He did remount, rode round the lap, and then came into the pits. His bike was obviously too trashed, but
you were sitting out in the same stands where he was heading last year.
Yeah, that's right.
And
I
believe you had a visitor then too, didn't you?
Oh, we had several. We had Nicky Hayden come across in the MotoGP. We had Hiroshi Aoyama, of course, run off, come back on, and everyone's thinking, "Ooh, race on," because he had to finish 11th or better to make sure he beat Simoncelli to the championship. And then, of course, Marco crashed anyway at turn two. And that took the pressure off. But a lot of people seem to be able to get that corner wrong. But Keenan was strange. It looked like he could make it. And Stefan Bradl made that corner. And then he just sort of sat the bike up, ran straight on, wobbled and flopped. And then shortly afterwards, I think only two or three laps afterwards, we had Stefan Bradl himself lost the front going through the infield. And he slid off. It was, in fact, two laps later. So we lost Bradl as well. And then we got this really good little punch-up going up at the front with Simon desperate to win, Iannone desperate to win, Tom Luthy and Tony Elias with Scott Redding and Carol Abraham tucked in with them but slightly off. And then Carol Abraham closed the gap. And there was this awful moment. Tony punted inside. This was the last turn off the mini back straight just before they go into the long final left-hander.
Right.
And he dived up the inside, clipped the back of Iannone's bike, took out virtually, well, he banged off Simon. Tony wobbled off the track and managed to regain the track and finished 30th in the end. But we then had Iannone and Simon both wobbling quite remarkably. Carol Abraham nipped through and won the race.
Yeah.
And he held them off for, well, that happened, it wasn't the penalty, I think it was three laps from the end.
Yeah.
So he held them off for a couple of laps, and he did good.
And you do have to give a pat on the back, though, to Iannone, because as has been the case all year, he has a tendency to get out front and then kind of fall off when his tires go off, and that was the case this time. But he really stuck it out in front of those guys for a long time.
Yeah.
And he was having to adapt his lines so much. He was riding a combination of real wide swoopy lines on corner entrance, but which basically opens the door and is an invitation for somebody to come through. But then his initial corner exits were actually kind of slow because he couldn't actually get on the gas that hard. And it was kind of messy, and it made for a lot of potentially dangerous-looking passing opportunities. When Tony came up, Tony actually passed Simone, if you remember, in that corner, and then all of a sudden found himself right up the back of Iannone. And it was a bit of a mess, yeah. But
I mean, Simon got sat up by people so many times in that race. It was incredible.
Yep.
And absolutely hats off to Julian Simon. He came in third behind Iannone, who was second. Tom Luthy, good steady race, was fourth, and Scott Redding fifth. A little bit further back from that pack, and then Alex De Angelis, Simone Corsi, and so on down. Notable mentions, Kenny Noyers came in 12th on the Jack and Jones, re-signed for next year. Alex de Bon 13th in his last race before he retires. Or that was the last we heard. And I did have to chuckle. Axel Pons crashed again, had to go back, go, "Dad, I've done another one." Sorry. So his pocket money is going to be docked this week, I suspect. But no, it was a fantastic race to finish, and it was almost a microcosm of the season. You know, drama, some really good racing, and an unexpected winner at the end.
But yeah, and if you speaking of pocket money, although probably of a different denomination, this was a bit of a relief, I'm sure, for a relief and a triumph at the same time for Carol Abraham, simply because he has been getting a fair amount of stick for, you know, having the daddy bought me a GP ride. So there you go. He got his win.
Yeah.
And it may not have been a dominating win, but it was certainly a convincing one in holding those guys off at the end. So, and there's no doubt that he's been doing a good job at the test, too. So,
I mean, and it's no doubt that if we were looking at pure rider potential and you had you didn't have to bring anything to the table in terms of sponsorship, you're looking at probably four or five Moto2 riders you'd pick before Carol Abraham. But as we've said before, and as Jules made the point, you know, he's got the opportunity. What do we expect him to do? Say, nah.
Nah, thanks.
Exactly. So the championship finished with Tony Elias on 271, crowned champion weeks ago. Julian Simon held off Andrea Iannone. There was 2 points between them at the end. So Julian Simon, second. Andrea Iannone, third. Some distance back, Tom Luthy, fourth. Simone Corsi, fifth. Gabel Talmasi, sixth. Jules Cluzel, who's, I think, mercurial is another apt description for him. He's very quick or he crashes. Eighth was Scott Redding. Ninth, Stefan Bradl. Tenth, Carol Abraham. Rounding off the top 10 for the season. And we have had a pretty firm announcement on riders and teams for next year, but we won't go into that this week because we've got far too much to talk about.
True. And, you know, actually it occurred to me when we were talking about you being out there in those stands, is Martin, this is in an oddball sort of way, if you think about it, sort of your anniversary of the beginning of your history with the show, because that weekend was the weekend that you had Mr. Julian Ryder trapped on a plane on the way back to the UK.
Yep.
And recorded interviews for us. No,
that was Catalonia.
Was it Catalonia?
Yeah, that was on the way back from Catalonia because we took off, and as soon as the seatbelt sign went, I said, there's a seat next to you, I'm just going to have a word, and completely abandoned Sharon, who's not the happiest of flyers, and she had to bring in a substitute hand crusher for the landing when we got back to Liverpool because I was still sat with Julian Ryder talking bikes. So Pete Jones, the friend that we go with, and he was at Valencia this weekend.
He
got his hand. He held her hand for the landing and got his knuckles cracked for his trouble.
And she still agreed to marry you.
I know, it's strange, isn't it? I think it's a sympathy wedding on my behalf. She's like, oh, well, poor fella.
she says, I can fix that.
Yeah.
All right.
But it was the end of season and last round email I sent, which you guys said, well, stick it in voice form. And,
That's right, okay.
And I was thinking next year I'm going to have to get out for Valencia and stay for the test because that will be our first sight of the 1,000cc's, which will be cool.
No doubt, no doubt. I've been pestering you about it, but you need to firm out which races you might be able to make next year because we need to get our schedule together for that.
Absolutely.
And in fact, even more emails and contact stuff and people about me potentially getting over, and so it's becoming more and less potential and more firm for the TT and maybe some additional time. So it's on my mind, folks, and thank you very much for all the very kind offers and whatnot. And as soon as I've got some better idea as to when and how it's going to happen, I will let you know, and I will certainly be in touch with those of you that have been in touch with us/me. So thank you. All right, on to the premier class, and then we'll talk some testing after that.
Yeah, we had a good race.
Mm-hmm.
For Valencia, which doesn't always give the best racing, this was pretty darn cool. Everyone got away fairly sweetly, and initially we had the Ducatis leading the way with Casey and Nicky, and Danny Pedrosa got not a rocket start, but a good start. He was up there. Jorge Simoncelli, Spies, and Rossi, Dovi, all in a pretty compact pack, dicing it up. Within a couple of laps, though, we saw a Ducati lose the front and just fly off again at turn one.
And to quote that rider, as he said later on Twitter, he said, well, I can't even do the accent, but if you're going to lose the front, you might as well do it. If you're going to lose the front in a big way, you might as well do it while you're up near the front.
And I must admit, I thought, oh, there's Casey gone again, but it wasn't. It was Nicky, and he did not look happy, did he?
Well, there were a lot.
He was stamping off.
There were a lot of people that automatically, as soon as that time, he had been very closely dicing with Pedrosa, that, Danny's done it again. And in fact, I remember Gavin Emmett even, Gavin, made the same comment. And I was thinking it, but I was kind of waiting because they didn't have it on camera. Until a bit later in the race, but no, indeed, that was all in Nicky's own, and he just lost the front, and the bike was severely worse for wear. It looked like it broke, probably up near where the swinging arm meets the frame, and it looked like it probably broke the steering head. So the thing ended up being a bit of a chopper. I saw a picture of it from somewhere, and it was done. What's the name of that new Ducati chopper?
Diavolo or something.
Yeah, it kind of looked like that, only a little racier.
Yeah.
He was
Nicky. Unfortunately, he popped off, and we had Casey, and Danny initially. Fighting away, and we had Lorenzo and Simoncelli. And Simoncelli and Lorenzo swapped paint, tire rubber, places on a number of occasions, and I mean, Marco Simoncelli, harsh but fair. You know, I mean, I don't think there was anything that was too brutal.
In fact, the one time when at the final quarter, when Lorenzo nearly came off.
Came out of the seat, didn't he? I mean, he basically crashed, but the bike stayed upright and he landed back on it.
Yeah, I bet if we got a good look at his right knee slider or left knee slider after that race, it was probably ground down to the minimum.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And he then dropped back to seventh, I think. Valentino came through, Danny came through, Dovi came through. I can't remember if Ben actually got past him. I don't think he did. But Simoncelli cheerfully went on, and his quote at the end of the race was, "Yeah, I fought with everyone." He thought, "Yeah, you did." I mean, he's, you know, they say, "Oh, there's no respect from there." Well, he's not going to get out the way.
Right.
You know, he's there to race, and I quite understand that. And to be fair to him, I think Jorge was doing a lot of head shaking. I think that's in the heat of the moment. I don't think he was head shaking with it. He shouldn't do that to me. But he really didn't show enough of his bike on that last corner to be able to expect Simoncelli to yield the ground.
To be fair, the idea that I got when in that one particular corner when he nearly crashed was he was shaking at it himself because he didn't show near enough of a wheel, and I think he just misjudged the corner and rode up his inside. And Simoncelli had, you know, he basically had tire marks all the way up his left leg and onto like his left arm as well. So it was a little
interestingly, and this was the point made by the Eurosport commentators. When Rossi went past him, Simoncelli could have done what he's so good at, is just easing off the brakes and delaying his turn in to hold someone, you know, to stay ahead of somebody, and he didn't.
Yeah.
And you think, is that because it was Rossi, or did he just catch you unawares? But he shredded his tyres, and, I mean, he's not the most sympathetic tyre rider there is, I don't think, Simoncelli. Yep. And he started to struggle later on in the race, ending up dropping back to sixth. But then we saw Jorge do a Rossi, basically, and from seventh, he popped his way past. He got past Valentino fairly cleanly and without too much trouble. Danny, meanwhile, was starting to suffer and going backwards. He ended up seventh. But I expected to see Casey disappear over the horizon. I didn't think he was catchable, and then he got hauled in slowly but surely, and Jorge got past him. And that's how we finished, with Jorge winning from Casey by a 4.5-second gap, quite comfortable. Similar gap back to Valentino, who got onto the podium for his last Yamaha race, which was really nice to see. And Ben Spies, who'd been having a really good dust-up with the Dovizioso-Simoncelli-Pedrosa battle, and he got past all of them as they beat each other up with some really masterful passes. He likes that track, I think.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. Which is interesting considering that it was not his best World Superbike track. He had a good crash out of there, if you remember, last year. So well done, well done. I think he just wanted to finish the year out strong, especially with his migration to the factory team.
And, of course, he went into this race on tied points with Nicky Hayden. So with Nicky crashing out and Ben coming fourth, he wins the Top American Award, which I don't think is an official one. But it's bragging rights. And we also discovered last week that him and Colin Edwards, if anyone hasn't seen, it's on MotoGP.com. There's a, Azzi Farni does a very good 10-minute chat with them. Parental guidance required for Colin, obviously, because he uses language other than English, or it's English but Anglo-Saxon English.
Yeah, if you could watch this show or listen to this show, you could probably watch that.
yeah, that's true. And it turns out that their marker board for their tequila challenge through the season was Simoncelli. If you come behind Simoncelli, you owe a tequila shot. And I think it was five. Colin owed five and Ben owed three going into this round. So Colin, presumably on Sunday night, had to do six because he came behind Marco, and Ben came ahead, so he was probably on his three, so they had a tequila shot competition.
And I'm not sure, if you, did you watch the awards show that was live?
No, I didn't, no.
Okay, because Ben was there to get his Rookie of the Year, and then and he came out, and he was gracious for that and everything, and Jenny Gao was from BBC was doing the presentation along with a Spanish gentleman who I didn't know. But and so they kept bringing, you know, people out, et cetera, et cetera. And finally, in the end, they brought everybody out that won award. And at that point, Ben came out and he kind of had this look on his face like, okay, can we go now? it was very interesting. Actually, it was also interesting from a, not that I am certainly any fashion king, but watching the various things that guys wear to the awards ceremony. I think Anoni probably won the most grungy award as far as no, that's always fun if you can ever catch it. They usually they broadcast it live on MotoGP.com the night of the Valencia race, but most people are usually out partying or flying back home somewhere, and are not usually where it's on. In fact, we got it, and we're about to dive into it, but we got a great bonus this year, which I cannot remember if we've ever had, which was live coverage of the test, although that was a bit squelched, or squelched is probably the perfect word for it, if you want.
Yes. Nothing much happened at first.
No, and in fact, I decided to stay up for it. I sent a letter off to my real-world boss because I thought I was going to have the opportunity of a lifetime for an interview as well, which didn't come to fruition. But I stayed up for it, and it started off raining. And let's back up a little bit. So Monday was Moto 2. Let me scroll down here in our notes because I had moved away from that. But we came out for that. And the one thing that ties in with what we were just talking about, Martin, was there's no doubt that, and I know for a fact that there were people enjoying themselves over at Colin's motorhome. And he was prepping and congratulating and having a great time for finishing out the season. And I'll leave it at that. Colin had a little bit of business to take care of in the morning because he was going to be riding on the Tech 3 bike on Monday, Tech 3 Moto 2 bike.
And he did, and he put in 54 laps on it. So it wasn't just a couple of spin rounds and tell him what you think. He put some blooming good effort in there. And Bradley Smith and Mike D'Amelio also out putting in the laps. Bradley did 90. Now, Bradley was riding this year's bike. Colin and Mike D'Amelio were testing next year's bike. But certainly we had a lot of guys looking at their new bikes. And, I mean, the timesheets, it's far too early to read too much into it. But it's interesting just seeing the guys with their new teams. Mm-hmm. Both your Spargo brothers, Keenan Sofwoglu, the newcomers. We had Yuki Takahashi moving across to the Crimea GP Moriwaki. Alex De Angelis confirmed for next year. And, of course, we had the 125 guys coming up. Max Neukirchner across for the MZ Racing Team. And Ant West's gone across to the Bimota. So, Mika Kallio as well. Of course, Scott Redding's new teammate at Mark VDS. And there was some interesting stuff going on. We had some of the riders for next year didn't ride, didn't go out and run, but we didn't have a 125 test. And
no, and that's not that unusual, actually. And you kind of wonder, well, why would you? You know, it was interesting to see that, like you say, the shuffling of the Moto 2 guys, and it will be, it seemed like we had a fair amount of more people coming on the Suter chassis, and so there is a bit of consolidation going on there, I'm looking forward to it, but you're right, you're exactly right, the post-Valencia test is really just a shakedown and a, hi, how you doing? I'm so-and-so, and let's make sure that we're good to work together and we understand what our methodology is. So these numbers aren't to be taken for anything. And frankly, I've always said that preseason testing, while it's fun and it's neat, it doesn't always tell you the whole story, even all the way up until, as we used to affectionately call it, G0. So very cool. The weather was kind of crap, basically, for all 3 days of testing. We had a lot of wind that guys were having to deal with, and that was a complaint across all 3 days. We had intermittent rain coming down, but for the most part, Moto2 guys were pretty good, and clearly, as you can see, Martin, we had some guys running some big numbers of laps out there. It was very impressive on some of those guys' parts. So Smith with 90 laps, I mean, that's a lot of riding.
Yeah, I know. I mean, what stage you get to when you say, okay, I'm not actually getting any benefit out of this because I'm so tired, I can't, you know, put in a consistent lap. I don't know, but that's just a lot of time.
Well, I mean, that's truthfully what you're looking at is anybody coming in and getting onto a new bike, even if it's with the same team or an updated model, they're going to spend an awful lot of time at the beginning just getting themselves comfortable on the bike, making the changes that are needed to fit the bike to them, be that clip-ons, rear sets, moving the seat forward and back, minor adjustments to get them to close enough of a baseline so they can at least try and understand and have some information to go on in the long, dark days that we have coming up ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I'm sure a lot will have been taken from the test. And, of course, they've now got till the beginning of February before the next test at Sepang to apply the changes that they might feel are appropriate. Then we had on Tuesday and Wednesday, we had the MotoGP test and so much anticipation, slightly tempered by the fact that, of course, Valentino, as part of the agreement of him going to Ducati, was gagged. He wasn't allowed to come and talk about it. Casey was.
Yeah.
Although he had... Go on.
Yeah, he certainly was. And, in fact, he was, I think the term is, ebullient.
Yeah, he was. I've not seen Casey so beaming since he came back from his illness during last season and won a race. He looked really happy. And there were some rather disingenuous questions from journalists trying to get him to compare it to the Ducati. And he'd already said, I'm not going to talk about the Ducati out of, you know, respect to them. And he battered them away with great cheerfulness. And he ignored, supposedly on day one, he ignored a box sign for three laps, just having fun. And he was second quickest on day one. Now, I mean, we've talked about this before. You can't read too much into testing. It's not a race. You don't know who's testing new parts, who's being sent out there just hit consistent laps so we can look at differences. You know, but we had Jorge Lorenzo quickest on next year's bike. Casey, the second quickest. And what you can draw from that is he is immediately at home on that Honda. And he seemed very happy with it. Ben Spies was the third quickest on day one. Danny, and interestingly, when you look at the official MotoGP timing sheet, it says Danny Pedrosa, Repsol Honda team, Andrea Dovizioso, Repsol Honda team, Casey Stoner, HRC.
Well, I'm pretty sure that the Repsol affirmation of their additional 2 years for the three guys didn't come out until, was it late Monday night or might even have been Tuesday midday? I mean,
I think the entry list for the test may well have been done before.
Indeed.
But of course, thinking about that next year, we do have the prospect of the Livio Supo Alberto Puig punch up, which we're all looking forward to. We had Marco Simoncelli was out in the San Carlo Honda and the Cressini Honda, and he was fifth quickest. Andrea Dovizioso sixth quickest. Colin with a real, I mean, another 50 lap or 49 laps he put in. But interestingly, the Suzuki confirmed that they're only going to run one bike next year for Alvaro Bautista, which a lot of people had suspected. And Alvaro, in reasonably cold conditions, eighth quickest in the test, and putting in some really good consistent laps. That's quite promising. And then we had...
It's more so promising because Suzuki is rarely good in the cooler conditions, so...
No, I mean, that's the one bike in it. We know it's quick when everything's in its favour. Mm-hmm. It doesn't like long radius corners. It doesn't like cold, so it hates PI, which the results have borne out. But, yeah, it was. It wasn't warm. It was mild at best, and, yeah, he was doing pretty well. Then we had Nicky... on the factory Ducati 9th and Valentino 10th. You can't draw too much into it.
Nope.
Randy on the Pramac 11th, getting to grips with it quite nicely. And looking down, 14th was Cal Crutchlow, one of the new arrivals, 16th Tony Elias, 17th Carol Abraham, but no one massively off the pace.
Yeah, David Emmett had a great little... And it's a takeaway quote that I got from him today when he was talking about René Dupuynier on the Pramac bike and talking about the comparisons between him and Rossi and, you know, why. The thing that was kind of a drag about the gag order, if you will, on Rossi was it would have been nice to hear from him directly what his issues were. But they're fairly clear and there's enough paddock whispers going on. The difficulty that he was having was with the front end of the Ducati, which has been a known issue for some time. And in the same vein, when people have problems with the front end, it's often is because they can't get the tire up to heat. And trying to get the tire up to heat when you think you're having front end issues, it's a chicken and egg, and neither are close enough for you to grab. You have to push through. And actually, David, another nod to you. You said something along the lines of when, you know, the planes were trying to break the sound barrier, they would get right up there and the plane would feel like it had to shake itself to death. And as soon as they broke through, the thing smoothed out. Well, it's the same kind of concept or analogy to be applied to the Ducati. But he said, well, the deal with Dupuynier, why he, you know, came to it not necessarily like a duck to water, was because Randy is just used to going in and, you know, plowing the front end, crash be damned. And so he didn't really necessarily have that fear and was able to hop on it right away, whereas we know that Valentino is very, very methodical the way he goes about things, which is...
I read that, and I did like the Randy, yeah, steams into a corner and knows he didn't crash because there's no gravel between his teeth.
Exactly. And,
yeah.
I think another... I'm not sure if it was David or another poster there had a great point, which was there's no doubt that Valentino, heading in for a shoulder operation in the next few days, certainly didn't want to crash the bike and have the opportunity to injure it further.
No.
At the same time, that we also know that there has been a fair amount of speculation over what is going on with Danny Pedrosa and his possible nerve damage. I'm not even going to say that. He was having issues with his left arm during the testing, and he's going to be going in for the full battery of tests on that, MRI, CAT scan, et cetera, et cetera. Vascular, probably I'm guessing an ultrasound, all sorts of stuff. So,
yeah, quite worrying for him, bless him.
Yeah. And so he'll be bombarded with all that, and maybe he'll come turn into the Incredible Hulk.
Yeah.
Doubtful. But yeah, no, the testing was really cool. And again, major props to MotoGP.com for putting it on live. That was cool. Even if it, you know, I made it through Valencia and I'm like, oh, finally I can go back to regular sleep schedule. Well, no.
not till after this.
Not yet.
And hats off to Hector Barbera. 76 laps on day one of testing. And Loris, beaten up though he has been recently and didn't finish the race, 71 laps. And then day two, with very similar times and groupings from a lot of people, Hector Barbera did 100 laps. I mean, for goodness sake, that's incredible.
Well, you know,
really.
The other thing is you look at it too and you think that's the most laps we've seen out of Casey since the beginning of the year.
Yeah. Day two, Casey was quickest by a tenth of a second from Jorge. 63 laps Casey put in. Jorge only did 30. Quite happy. Ben Spies, third. Simoncelli, Pedrosa, Hayden, Bautista, Dupuynier, Dovizioso. Yes, everyone's waiting for the name that's missing. Ayama Barbera, Edwards, Crutchlow, Caparossi, 15th, Valentino Rossi. Again, it's, you know, he did 70 laps. They're going to go away with an awful lot of information. And I think the key is, will Ducati listen?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if Ducati listen, then they're undoubtedly going to benefit from the Rossi Burgess effect.
Right.
Well, if they think they know best. Mm.
Alex Briggs said something along the lines of, you know, for the last couple of years at Yamaha, that he basically felt like they were tuning. And he said that this was perhaps the most exhaustive test that he's had in forever. And he's been around there for 11, 12 years. And that he felt like they were working. And that Ducati was intending, and Preziosi said this basically the same thing. We've got a lot of work to do, but we've got a good direction to go in. So it bodes well. We'll have to see. It will be very interesting. But they clearly have a lot vested in this, and I'm looking forward to see what happens.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's worth mentioning as well, the at the end of the race, just jumping back to the race, Valentino had a T-shirt with Bye Bye Baby.
Yeah.
Which was really cool, and he stopped the bike out on the track and gave her a kiss. And it was really quite touching, and you just think back to, it was Welcome, wasn't it, that first race where he sat and everyone thought he was crying because his shoulders were shaking. He said, "Nope, I was laughing," when he won that first race out in the M1. So it was really nice to see him on the podium. I think it was entirely appropriate. It's a shame he couldn't win the last race and bookend that Yamaha career. There was a lot of emotion, but it was really positive, and I'm glad that Yamaha agreed to let him test, because it would have just left a nasty aftertaste.
Oh, really?
To what has been a legendary relationship.
And in fact, there was a long press conference on Sunday afternoon following the race with Lynn Jarvis, Masao Furusawa, and Valentino Rossi, full of journalists, and a lot of people got questions in. But it was, for those of you that haven't seen it, hopefully you have, and if you have not, it is on MotoGP.com. You will have to have a subscription. But it was excellent. And definitely catch that. If you'd had a season pass and you're not going to be signing up for the postseason stuff, catch it soon, because your subscription is due to end on the 14th. So,
but thank you, MotoGP, because we did mention this a couple of weeks ago, because they did include the test in the season pass video access.
Yes, indeed. And so,
and for that, we're grateful.
Very, very. Maybe they listen, Martin. Nah.
Yeah. Well, you never know. Stranger things have happened at sea.
Very true. Very true. So, a fantastic ending weekend. A lot of intrigue to go into in the postseason. Martin, let's go ahead and listen to Mark's bit, and then we'll put our brains together and see how we can finish this one out. How's that sound?
Absolutely fine.
All right. Roll on, Mark. And those of you who might want to pause here and go out and get a beverage and put your feet up. This is the long one.
And don't let the kids listen.
All good.
This is a professional operation, sir.
Know it.
Hi, Bureau.
Hello, team. How are you?
I'm wonderful. How are you?
Not bad.
Are you ready to go to Macau?
I'm not going.
What?
She's going to skip this one.
Oh, slacker.
Well, she's gone to the last couple, and it's about $2,000, so she's going to spend the money on a different trip, is what we're going to do.
Come visit me.
I won't be far, actually.
We'll talk later.
Yeah. You should be recording this.
I am recording it.
Oh, hello. Hello, world. So, Veronique, you going to go see Jim up north? Well, I'm gone.
Ooh la la.
I do have some vacation time coming. Anyway.
Oh, here we go. All right, let's turn that down. Can you hear me
okay?
Yeah,
I can hear you fine.
All right.
What are we doing? Let me see. Last we talked, we had your killer stories about, and we actually got some kick-ass feedback from that, the Roberts tour of the ranch. That was awesome. We wandered through a whole bunch of things. There was some, and I know that you're probably going to want to touch on this call. There was some people out there that were like, he's riding too fast on the street, et cetera, et cetera. And you and I come from a similar mind bent, and some people don't quite understand, so we may hit that. You did release, and I would like to think I had something to do with that, though I don't think I did, your 1993 PIR video, which was awesome.
That was, you know, not part of this last documentary we spoke about. That was just back, like, in the day when we would make, I made a video each year for friends that were in the immediate group of ours, and that was part of that older video.
But still.
Scott Russell, Doug Poland, oh, man. I mean, that's just, for me, that's the beginning of life, you know. That's when I started to
live. Totally. You know, and for me, having raced and, you know, people that go to the races have no idea what that feeling is when you roll in and the sun's coming up and you're getting in and people are just getting set up and it's still dark, it's still cold, you're wandering around, and the feeling in the paddock is kind of one of isolation, especially if you're a bit of a newbie or, you know, a small fish in a really freaking big pond.
That's a really good word to describe it. You do feel kind of isolated and you're like, man, what am I? Did I bite off too much? I mean, What do I belong here? At the same time, you're like, you know, we got to perform. You got to step up. Even if you're just starting out, you don't want to be the guy that maybe gets in the way. You don't want to be the guy that would crash and take somebody else that's important. I mean, can you imagine getting lapped? I wasn't getting lapped all that much in my life, but by the time I went to the big races, but once in a blue moon, I'd get lapped right at the beginning. You're like, I don't want to be the guy that screws it up because it's probably the last lap. And it's on TV, and if you're the guy that takes out Scott Russell when he's making the pass on somebody, you know, it's like, you don't want to be that dork. So I think you're more intimidated at the very beginning of your AMA racing, at least I was, than way later when you're actually racing in the front. That's a lot more, you know, you're at least in control.
Had you already raced at PIR, or was that your first time there?
No, that was, we had at least a club race there. It may have been two or three, but... it's a dangerous track. I've got another clip that you might see in the future. I'll put it out where I've got the aftermath of Pagram and Donald Jacks and hit the ball. And I was right there, right there. It's so ugh.
You still need to bring your stuff out. I think even your mom commented on that. She's like, I've got a bunch of VHS tapes down in the – and I'm like, dude, just bust them out.
I don't know. I've been so focused on just being, you know, doing my thing that now as I'm getting older, I'm looking back on some of that stuff going, you know, it's kind of cool. Maybe we'll...
You need to, like, you know, have a summer intern or something.
Yeah. Hey, would it be all right to say, for me to say that I've really enjoyed this year's MotoGP season?
Oh, dude, we can totally talk about MotoGP. Hold on, I need to... Mr. Miller, meet Mr. Foster.
I ran to the store to get some beer so we could talk.
Sweet.
Tonight.
Yeah, you know, in fact, I did. You and I sort of concurrently watched a bit of practice the other day, but I stayed up real late last night trying to catch the first test of the season. Mark and I are currently talking on Tuesday night prior to Friday's show, and unfortunately, rain kind of held that back. But yeah, no, it's been a great season, and frankly, it's going to be a great one to come.
I made it until Colin Edwards was done being a guest, which was a really cool addition to the boredom of waiting for something to happen. And then Rossi got on the track, and as soon as he got off the track, I came. And
that was the money. Game over.
I mean, what else is there? Like, they watch, you know, Caparossi go around again. I don't, you know.
It's, if you think about all the permutations that are changing for 2011, and frankly, really, what is going to happen in 2012, because this is coming up on the last year of the pure 800s, and we're going back to some of the, what you might consider more muscle bikes, even though some of the rules are a little bit, we'll see how they shake out, because they're never written in stone until basically somebody's turned a lap with them. I think it's going to be cool. You know, Stoner on the Honda is going to be a real force. Rossi over there on the Ducati.
It's P2 in his first day.
Well, you got to remember, and some people are mocking me for this, that he raced on a Honda RC211V last year, the 990s in 2006. So,
yeah, but still.
I know, and it was for LCR, and he was getting shitty tires. But And the thing is, though, you know, somebody's going to hit it right away. But on the other hand, people always forget and they get caught up in the excitement of the test that everything that happens right now really doesn't mean jack until the first race. You know, even the indications. We've seen guys the last 2 years, it looked like Suzuki was coming back, you know, over the winter test. But, you know, what's happened there, and they're, you know, waning even further, going to one bike team next year. It's crazy. The winter tests are neat, and frankly, it's great for the – but I think everybody holds their cards close to their chest all the way through.
Mm-hmm. I think it's very true, and I also think that a lot of times some guys get as you'll read after the fact, that they were testing things. The A rider that you would think would have smoked, for instance, Rossi was faster than Hayden. You don't know, maybe Hayden was actually riding. He was the development guy on the day, and Rossi was just given the package that's known to work and just ride the motorcycle. So you never know, like, behind the scenes, if somebody's saying, well, we're just testing things like crazy, like Pedrosa, for instance, is on the new prototype bike, etc. He might be slower because of it, and it really doesn't mean an effing thing, you know, today. You know, it just really, really doesn't mean anything. But it's cool to see Ben Spies up there. It's cool to see, you know, it's so exciting. My God, what a year. What a freaking year. I watched both races, Moto2 and MotoGP, the last two weekends twice.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it's very cool, and it really portends of things to come. And it looks like he's truly gathered and carried on, you know, his team all the way from the AMA, or at least both Hout and Woody.
Yep.
And that kind of continuity, and as well as Marigali coming over from World Superbike to support him, that's going to be a great team. And he's so freaking methodical about the way that he goes about things, and I'm still on the mark to talk to him at some point. Really do want to have him on the show, because I have lots of questions. I'd like to think that I don't ask the normal questions.
Well, you need to ask him what they did Sunday night, all of them.
Yeah, well,
because they didn't have to do anything till Tuesday, so you know that Monday was written into the schedule so they could recover.
Well,
you know,
the thing that I was impressed by, frankly, because if there's one person in the paddock that probably started pretty much, and not probably, I'm pretty sure, and I've got a couple of things that he did. Collins Motorhome was ground zero on Sunday afternoon and evening, and he was riding a Moto2 bike on Monday, so. Tip of the hat to him. Well done.
He's the real deal.
He's a total character. Do you know about the deal he's doing? His ranch down in Texas. He's got he'll be doing. You can basically pay and go down there, and he's got a bunch of dirt tracks laid out. It's kind of like, you know, the Roberts Ranch. Although he also has like archery ranges and gun ranges, and he'll take you out fishing. And they have a saloon on.
Got to pay him to be his friend or what?
I think so. Yeah.
Would you like a short Colin Edwards story? Because I have
go for it.
All right. I have ridden dirt track with Colin Edwards. It was in Colorado with Danny Walker.
Supercamp.
Yeah. It was his very first one ever, and it was back. I don't even know how. I think it might have been that he had done a couple trial super camps at a Ken Maley's ranch, so I got to know Danny even better. And I think it went beyond that. And Chris Carr was one of his main in-house instructor guys, and he was at Ken Maley's a bunch. So they actually invited me, and it paid my way to go out to his very first thing and be a guest instructor kind of thing, but also with Colin Edwards and also with Vito Gresci.
Yeah, he's the manager for the Ducati team now.
He's the guy that was, which I met recently, you know, when we were in Europe, as you know, this whole year, when we went to Catalonia for the MotoGP race, you know, I got introduced to Vito, and he's looking at me, says, I know you, and I said, I know you too, you're at the fucking, we were trying to figure it out, we thought that he had raced an AMA 1 year, but that turned out to be a different Italian for Ferracci back in the day.
Yeah, Giovanni Borse.
No, it was before him. It looks a lot like Gresci, but in any case, Colin Edwards was there. But here's a cooler story than that, is back in like 93, when you saw the video, when, you know, particularly myself was just starting out as a club racer and stuff like that, doing my very first AMA race. Colin was on the fast track. He had just gotten to the Vance and Hines Superbike team, and he led that first race in 1993 at PIR, and he went on to go World Superbike. But at that year, I think he had already gone the next year or the year after, he went to World Superbike, and he was a marquee guy. He was in the front. He was winning races, and he had a lull in performance, and then all of a sudden he started winning again. And they interviewed him on TV one day, and I didn't know him then at all. I've never even met the guy. The Danny Walker thing was quite a bit later. He said on this interview in TV that the reason why I started winning again is because I bought these audio tapes from some guy like Tim Robbins, who is a motivational speaker. And he says, I listened to these cassette tapes once, because once you hear it, you don't need to hear it twice. And I went back to the racetrack and changed my attitude, and now I'm winning the world championship. And I saw this on TV. It might have been 1995 or 6, or I don't remember exactly when it was, but he was still quite young. So I got his phone number. It's a true story. I'm like this little kid, and I got his phone number, and I called Colin Edwards, and I said, hey, I'm a dork from California. I race club racing, and I suck, but I heard your interview, and I was curious if you could just tell me the name of the guy so I could go buy the same cassette tapes that you just listened to, because it sounded like it worked. And I'll take anything I can get. And he says, well, we'll tell you what, give me your address and I'll go to the post office and put it in the bubbly bag and I'll send it to Stranger and make a copy of all the tapes. There's like 8 of them. And just send me this, you know, $400 cassette deck book back when you're done doing it. Because he was late. His story was that he was up late one night listening to this to nothing, you know, the TV at 4 in the morning, and this idiot got on and said, I'll change your life, buy my tapes for $400. So the moral of the story is Colin Edwards was cool enough to send a complete stranger, club racer, his $400 worth of cassettes on the trust that I would send them back, even after he never met me, and I just called him out of the blue and says, what's the name of the guy? And he says, here you go. Cool guy, right?
That's very cool. I was kind of waiting for you to say, no, actually, that was a bullshit story that I made up for TV.
No, but I listened to the tapes, and they're really badass. And I'll tell you, the only thing that I can retain today about those tapes that I thought was worthy, and I think it's what worked for him, is that no matter where you are in your life, you have to see it as being perfect in the moment. Because if you question that, if you question the fact that anything isn't as it should be, you're doing a disservice.
Interesting.
So always look at it as like, this is what I've got in front of me, and now I'm going to approach it as being exactly as it should be and work hard to change it for the better and what I think is better, blah, blah, blah. But it's also perspective. The audio cassettes were saying something about it. Sometimes the thing is the same, but how you look at it changes. For instance, if you hear a tiger in your back seat of your car while you're driving, you get scared and you look back and you think it's something, you see red eyes, and the next thing you know, it becomes a toy. So you get from scared shitless to thinking you've got to pull over and jump out of the car to realizing it's a toy and laughing about it. Well, it was always a toy to begin with. So it's how you see things. I don't know. But that was Colin Edwards, like, learning how to go faster on the racetrack from that. And I was like, wow, that's really kind of a
trick. I'm gonna keep that one in my pocket for next time I get a chance to talk to him. Colin, do you have a copy of those tapes from back in 93?
You should ask him about that. I wonder if he remembers, because he'll remember my name, because when I see him at the shows, you know, he remembers me from Danny Walker, but we're not like close buddies or anything. But when I walk up and I say, hey, what's up, Mark Miller? And he's like, I know. Like, I know you are. You're an idiot. You know, like, why would you say that? It's super cool guy. But anyway, that's my Colin Edwards story.
Cool. And that's frankly a great moral of the story. I like that perspective. And that was a bit of depth, if you will.
I think motorcycle racers are a lot smarter than people think, meaning they're a lot deeper than people think.
And I would have to agree with you, frankly. This is really not an easy sport. A lot of people think you just hop. Well, certainly not our audience, because most of them are far more sophisticated than that. And I'm not meaning that as a suck-up to our audience. I'm just saying that the only way you could listen to this show was if you had a modicum of interest in the depth of motorcycle road racing. But, I do have a question for you at current events. I just caught something just briefly. There was apparently some mystery missile that took off from down in Southern California last night.
Yep.
And it was kind of basically off the coast of where you guys are, right?
That was, I'm told that was Laurel Allen, Jim Allen from Dunlop's daughter's fault. She apologized profusely on Facebook.
Oh, I love it. That's funny. Good for you, Laurel. Was it Jim Allen's? He's preparing his next adventure now that he's retired from Dunlop.
You know, back to Laurel, because she's more interesting to me right now. And I've got my girlfriend sitting like across the room, so I have to be careful what I say. But what a cool little girl that is. Do you know Laurel? Have you met her?
I haven't met her. I don't think she would remember me if I saw her face to face. I am friends with her and have talked with her through Road Racer X, Chris Jonham, and the like. But yeah, she's very cool. And she's cute. She's cute in a very Veronique sort of way.
Yeah, no, she just seems like a really artsy, kind of cool, down-to-earth, throwback, you know, almost tree-hugging hippie from Berkeley kind of
thing. Exactly.
She seems like a really cool person. I've never met her, but the second we started exchanging emails, we, like, hit it off as far as the sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
Any cute little girl that would post a photograph from her phone of the shit that's fallen out of the outhouse onto the floor, and then put some color tinge to it in Photoshop, and put it on her profile picture in Facebook, is, you know, we're going to get along fine. That's Jim Allen's daughter. If you don't know who Jim Allen is, he was, like, the guy you needed to know and like and love at the Dunlop tire organization.
Absolutely.
Your racing.
And perhaps the best smile in road racing.
Yeah, right? Did you see the 1993 Jim Allen smile?
I did.
Right.
I've got a few pictures of me next to him with that exact same smile on it. Wears through the ages quite well.
I got to tell you one last thing on Jimmy Allen, because he's the coolest guy and deserves this. But Henny Ray Abrams put together you talk about the biggest surprise of my year. This year was not crashing at the 24-hour race. It was getting an email from Henny Ray Abrams out of the, you know who that is, yeah. The photographer? Cycle News.
Yeah, recently retired because Cycle News shut down.
Oh, I didn't hear. So Henny Ray Abrams has retired from after Cycle News?
He was doing some writing for them after they kind of very strangely wound down. I don't think he's retired. I think he's still probably doing stuff, but he's kind of gone quiet at the nonce.
All right. Yeah, and I called him a photographer, and I apologize because he's actually a journalist, not just a photographer. But my story is he emailed me while I was on the Isle of Man with Veronique recently, or actually about 6 months ago when I was living there, and says, "Hey, Jimmy Allen's retiring. We're having a big banquet for him, and I'm putting together a book. Would you please? I'm going to mail you. Give me your address in England. I'm going to mail it to you from California, and make a little note and sign your photograph and send it back for the party because I'm putting it in a big album. Would you please be a part of this and sign the thing and give it back so I can give it to Jim Allen?" I'm like, you're asking me like to be in the album? You know, he's going to ship it at, what, $13 cost to England for me to sign this photograph of me when I rode for Arian Honda and send it back. And it's like, man, that's cool. Thanks for asking.
Yeah.
To be part of the club at all, it feels good because I was remembered as somebody that was in the AMA at one point. But
you're not over the hill yet, Chief.
Well, we're getting there. But what I wrote on the damn picture, you know, on the Arian picture is I'll never forget the time that Jim Allen and, you know, you and my girlfriend at the time, Tammy, for 20 years, streaked with Randy Renfro butt naked through Siepkins, and my girlfriend slipped on the beer barefooted. And you caught my girlfriend butt naked, because he's butt naked, Jim Allen from Dunlop, running through the pub, which was a tradition back then. And that's what I wrote on the thing and signed it, you know, all the best and that kind of stuff. And, you know, it's about time he retired. You should have been out of the game a long time ago. But anyway, that was the Jim Allen. And my girlfriend apparently was the only girl to ever streak through Siepkins in the history of the tradition.
I do have to bring up a couple of things. A, 1993, Tammy's butt. But B...
Tammy's jeans.
Jeans. But B, you have mentioned, and for those people, and it is a vast audience now that's listening to us, and a lot of people overseas, you mentioned a very key classic historical bit of AMA racing and AMA post-race carnage, which is Siepkins. And you know what? We'll save that tidbit for another show, but that is a watering hole, if you will, outside, I want to say Road America, but that's not right, is it? It's
Road America.
Road America. Yes. And there are probably a billion stories that come out of that place, half of them involving Scott Russell.
Well, you know who else is Dave Sadowski?
Yep.
Well, you put beers in that guy, and he's got forearms like Popeye. You don't want to fuck with Scott with him. He's like a redhead, you know, redheaded, fiery guy. You know what redheads, how they have those
temper? I do remember, and in fact, when I was doing spotting for Speed Vision back in the day, he was announcing with Ralph Shaheen. And I do remember, I also attended races where he was still racing. We are doing what we do. Yeah. Let me see if I can drag us back, because I actually wrote down a couple of notes, which is very unusual for us. But you and I started talking in email, or at least asked you, and you came back to me. I asked you if you'd ever ridden a two-stroke, and you said you had, and you'd ridden Roland Sands spare bike, and I have a Roland Sands story I'll save for another day, but his TZ250 at Loudon, which is another one of those American courses that actually has a rather... not an infamous history, but it is, it's well lined with Armco, and a lot of racers kind of look at that place and go, tell me a little bit about that.
Well, as far as the track goes quickly, I was unfortunate enough to be holding the pit board for a dear friend of mine called Aaron Lanningham back, I don't even know, it might have been 93, because he was in that little video. Do you remember when he passed me and I passed him back? Well, we were close back then. We were buddies, and we traveled together and did a lot of stuff together. And he says, hey, man, can you work my pit board? She had no problem for the superbike race, because I guess I didn't do it or something. So he comes around one lap, and I give him the pit board. He comes around. He didn't come around the next lap. And I'm like, well, what happened? He crashed, apparently. So I go to the medical office, and I see his feet going into the medical door while it shuts behind him only. Mm-hmm. And about 3 hours later, they told me he was paralyzed from the waist down forever. And it was kind of like, what? Like, I one lap, he's my good buddy that I'm close to racing with and all this kind of stuff. The next lap, he's now paralyzed for life. So he's ended up doing, like, downhill snow skiing with special kinds of skis. I think he races cars. He got back on a motorcycle with the hydraulic kickstands. So, you know, he's got a great life. His wife stuck by him and still loves him to this day. But that's the loud and unfortunate on the safety issues. And I think who else? Brett, another guy crashed real hard. Him and I touched on the straightaway. But anyway, the 250 stuff, yeah, I did race one once. It was Roland Sands' a spare bike back when Roland Sands was kind of racing with Randy Renfro and DeLuzio and those, that crowd, and ended up winning. I think he won the championship his final year of AMA competition.
Oliver finished it out, unless Roland retired or left before that. I think it was, what year was that? It was 2000. Anyway, I know that he won near the end, but Rich Oliver pretty much had it. The 250 is pegged for his final run out. And actually, even kind of further than that, when they were running the they had the two-stroke thing going down at Willow Springs with their big races they were running, their big cash races.
Mm-hmm. Roland Sands is a very natural rider. He's a really good rider, and it's to his core. He could, like, not train. He could drink. He could do whatever he wants to do, pretty much. And on the day, he'll pull the pin out. And we used to train at Ken Mailey's ranch again, like sometimes a few times a week. Like, I'd go pick him up. Me and my training partner would go pick him up and wake him up out of bed, and literally almost sometimes pour him into the truck, the back of the truck, because he was hardly awake. And we would go race around in circles and stuff like that. And he's an artistic guy. He's a cool guy. He, back then, and I were sort of sharing a little bit of the travels. We were doing hotel rooms once in a while. He came from pretty successful family with Performance Machine. Yep. So his dad was his biggest sponsor, and he had access to a big truck and certain things. Him and Mark Foster, do you know who that is?
Mark raced AFM for a long time.
Well, Loudon, New Hampshire used to be so dangerous that they would put the purse higher than most races. And the 250 GP race, for some strange reason, it might have been a favorite of the owners, was off the charts. Superbike race to win back then, which was the biggest purse of the year. Let's just say it was $15,000 to win an AMA Superbike race at Loudoun. The 250 race to win was like 10 grand, which was a lot of money compared to normal. Sure. So I think it paid pretty well back down to sixth place. Long story short, too late. I asked him, I said, look, can I ride your fucking extra bike? Because you know, if I finish sixth, I'll still get like $3,700, which is a lot of money when you're that old and that, you know, you're poor and you're, anyway. So he let me do it. I crashed it once in practice because it had no engine braking and I just plowed the front right after passing him, funnily enough. But then raced it in there.
Was that a watch this moment?
Yeah. I just passed him and I said, you know what, you know, follow me, bitch. And, you know, jokingly, I said, follow me, you know, I'm on your spare bike now. I just passed you, so follow me. I'm thinking I'm cool. And the very next fast left flowing corner before the start finish line, the front straight, I just plowed the front because I'm like, oh, this thing doesn't weigh anything. A 250 gram pre bike is not a super bike. I mean, it's not a 750 super sport bike. It's not a modern super stock bike or a 600cc super sport bike. It's a little toy built for the racetrack. And it's the only time I ever raced one. And they are so light, you can almost flick them out from underneath you. Yeah. Like, to change direction.
Where do you finish in the race?
I think I finished six. But the thing that, to this day, I blocked out of my memory, because I still can't believe it, is James Randall from Northern California AFM circles. Yep. He fucking beat me. And to this day, I can't accept it. Like, it doesn't register because he's like 6'3", like 199 pounds, and he smoked my ass. Like, I was right there. We had a battle, if I remember correct, we were battling for fifth or something. And, of course, there was the Rich Oliver won it or something, and him and I had a battle, and I don't remember why he won, because I blocked it out. But anyway, the story is, if you know James Randolph, tell him I said hi, because we're good friends, but he beat me in that 1-250 race I ever did, and I'll never forgive him. You know,
he's still racing up here. Right? You should come back and have a couple of grudge match races, dude.
No, I'm scared. I'd get beat. I can't go to a club race and get smoked. I mean, it's just, I can't. I'm too fragile. Like, my ego would just be destroyed. Because there's fast guys at club races. You go to AFM. You go to Sears Point, which is now Infineon, they'll kick your ass. I mean, you go to Willow Springs, Jeremy Toy will kick your ass. You know, like, you've got to really work hard in California to do well at a club race, because the bikes are proper, the riders are proper, the teams are proper, the tires are proper, and it takes a lot of money and resources and development. Like, you have to really show up prepared if you think you're going to win a club race in California. You just can't do it.
That is true. And a proper tip of the hat to you for saying that, and for many years, going as far back as you want to think about, we've had champions coming out of here. Seems like Texas has a tendency to breed a few as well, no doubt.
So, can I say something real quick,
Jim? Dude, you can say whatever you want.
Somebody told me today that Chris Paris put it on the internet that he thinks he's going to run up front at Macau in his first year.
Good for him.
Which is good to hear that he's confident, but I really hope that he approaches the Macau Grand Prix coming up with a little bit of respect, because it's not a normal race. You make one error and you could punt a wall. And I really hope he just doesn't think it's going to be that easy. If he does it, great. Like, if he, you know, God bless. Like, I hope he does. But I hope he's only, what, he's like 26? Yep. I really, really hope that he just keeps it cool and works into it. Because if he thinks he's going to show up and smoke, it's not a club race. I mean, these guys, Stuart Easton's going to be there, Michael Rutter, John McGinnis. You may think they're big, tall, fat fucks or something like that, or, you know, whatever, BSB, because you've never seen them before. They don't suck. They're actually really good.
They don't suck, and they know where the limit is without overextending themselves. And not that Chris might not know that, but, and you know, you may run up front, but the bottom line, if I'm guessing when you read that, something is A, well, dude, be careful, and B, okay, you're going to run up front for how long?
Yeah, I just want him to be safe. That's
absolutely. Absolutely. Well, you know, I'm assuming, and I don't know, clearly there's also a bit of rivalry, and you still have a massively competitive streak in you, that you guys are still going to have a chat when you're over there. I mean, don't you guys band together a little bit?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, there's no question. There's no, for me, there's no real, you know, you'll be competitive. But you know what? With real roads racing, you go as fast as you can. Yeah. You don't really go much faster, although on the last lap you might take a risk, but you don't want to punt somebody else into the wall, but you also don't want to kill yourself. So you kind of just go as fast as you can. At least that's my approach. I don't think I'm going to go there this year, and I'm not, you know, to kick serious ass, although I say that because I'm sitting here on my cozy couch and, you know, on my computer desk. Once you get there, you're going to go as fast as you possibly can. And, you know, I got the Dunlops at the last minute, which was a nice thing. They're in the crates. They've made it there. So I'll be on the tires I'm comfortable with. I'm on a BMW, which is fast. But Jeremy Toy is a very, very good rider, you know. And these guys, Chris Paris, I'm sure, is a good rider. And I don't know about the Florida guy, but I'm sure he's fine. It's not so much like it's a competitive thing, like it's your teammate you have to beat, because there's too much at stake. You can't go in there gung-ho. If you go in there gung-ho like Guy Martin did the last two times he's been to Macau, you will shatter your wrists. You will fall down and smush yourself.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's also a bit like – or it's unlike the Isle of Man, because you can't go scout that thing. It's as you've said before, and is – okay, so let me just quickly transition this, because – clearly, the reason I'm here, the main reason besides loving talking to you, of course, is to talk about Macau, because today is the 9th of November. In 2 days, or no, this Saturday, I guess, you're going to be flying out for the race weekend, as it were, which is the 18th through the 21st. Is that right?
I think so. Okay.
And this will be your 10th tour of Macau this time?
It will, yeah. But I'm happy to talk to you because, Jim, because I was so fucking pissed off before we got on the line, because I found out, like I always do, I'm leaving a day earlier than I thought I was.
So you're leaving Friday?
I'm leaving Thursday night.
Oh, shit. Why?
Because I'm an idiot, and it said it was the 12th, and I'm thinking the 12th was Friday night at midnight for the 13th morning of Saturday at 00:05 a.m. because I take off at midnight, and I'm thinking, I've taken off midnight Saturday morning, which is Friday night, so I can train, you know, today, Tuesday, Wednesday on the R6 on the public roads, and then Thursday, and then Friday morning, because I'm putting new tires on my R6 tomorrow morning. And now I'm looked at it, because I got my itinerary with the actual itinerary, not just the blah, blah, blah. I looked at it one more time, and it said Friday. I said, no, that should say Saturday, because it's Friday night, but technically it's Saturday morning, and it turns out I'm leaving on Thursday. So, and I've missed more airplanes being an idiot like this in the past, coming from, in, you know, to and from the Isle of Man, et cetera. So now, it turns out I have, like, tomorrow to train, and maybe Thursday morning, because Veronique's going to, my girlfriend, my little French girlfriend here, is going to go visit my mom for a couple of days, the same day at the same airport, so we got to go even earlier. Anyway, my point
is... Wait, I thought that meant that she and I would have an extra day together.
Trust me, I'm going to get you two together, right? Don't you worry, Jim. After Steve Rapp takes her for an airplane ride.
Yes, well, yeah, I don't know if I can... Well, he's short, though.
He's not that short. But he does have that what is that actor that beat Rocky up in the fourth? He's a good-looking kid. I mean, he's a good-looking guy. Steve.
Did I sent you that picture of him sitting on my bike, didn't I? Way back in the day. Back in...
Him sitting on your bike?
Yeah, it was at the International Motorcycle Show. I had my piece of dookie, Kawi 250 there. And he was... That was when he was running for... I want to say Farachi. Yeah, it was Farachi on the Ducati, the year that he had that insane crash. Can't even remember where off the top.
On the front straight at Brainerd? Or no, Road America.
Yeah,
right?
His front end came off and did a flying leap. But anyway, at the end of the year, he was sitting on my bike in the AFM booth, because I had a very pristine race bike. In translation, I did crash it over the year, and so it looked good enough to throw in the booth.
Steve's a cool guy. He's a very, very smart guy. He's smarter than he looks. Tell him I said that.
Well, he may hear it at this point.
No, he's a good guy. He flies planes around. Listen, can we touch base a little bit on what we talked about on the police or driving?
We can.
Driving on the public.
We can, because I know, and for those of you that talk about it online and know that Mark does lurk and he does read things and he does react and he does have his feelings. So I yield the floor to you, sir.
Very simply, and just always remember that. I wish we could edit that. Can we not edit that, sir?
Yeah, you've always told me not to edit anything.
It's one opinion, first of all. Second of all, in my vast experience riding on the road, no matter what anybody else says, you're going to ride within your own limits. Yes, there are examples when if you hear somebody talking about riding fast, or your friends are riding faster than you, or somebody passes you and you try to keep up, or somebody gets behind you and says, I'll watch you go crash for me because you're going to try too hard. Typically, you ride within your limits on a public road on your own sport bike. I don't think it's as frequent that you're going to go out and ride over your head and kill yourself just because you've been lured in by ego or by, you know, you're trying. Maybe when you're young, yes, we've all kind of had the moment when we've been charged into a corner, it decreases radius, and you go wide, and you're like, thank God there wasn't a car there, or thank God I scrubbed the speed and I didn't, you know, go off the cliff or something like that. But I think for the most part, we are all smart enough to go at the speeds that we're comfortable with, that we know we can do, and we'll slowly, incrementally get a little bit quicker and safer, often because we went to the track day to learn how to trail brake better, to learn your motorcycle better, to panic brake. And yes, when I talk about riding on the public roads personally, and it's just one opinion, it's just little old me, I train on the public roads because not only because I race professionally on public roads, but I can't help but have exposure to that activity. You know, it's to me, it's like it's breathing. It's like water for a fish. I don't have any choice, but I live on the public roads on a motorcycle, and I've done it since I was a tiny little kid with big wheels down the hills and sliding around. Then you get into your first motorcycle, and the very first day you're off in the canyons, because it's blood, it's life, and it's only me. Not everybody is wired like that, but everybody needs to use their own head and take responsibility for that.
Let me point at least two things out. First off, you are not going out and going out in these group rides. You go out and you ride by yourself for the most part, for yourself, right?
Pretty much these days, I love to ride with other people. But when I do, I slow way, way down and just enjoy my friends. Right.
So the second thing is you're not, and or at least this is what I gather, and I think this is the thing that some people weren't actually picking up. You're not advocating people go out and tear up the canyons. That's not your point. Your point is, as you said, this is one person's opinion, and this is what I do. And I think a lot of people were like, taking things a bit the wrong way, or at least that's the way that I felt.
Again, it's you either can't help yourself or you can. I mean, like if you're drawn to this activity, which is motorcycle riding in general, and then furthermore on topic, if you find yourself needing to manipulate the machine around corners and you increasingly improve your motorcycles, you improve the tire freshness, you get better safety gear. This is the sport we love. You know, Jim, this is like we love MotoGP, we love World Superbike, we love AMA, and in our little nook, or also BSB, all the international listeners, we can't help. I'm talking to the people that can't help themselves. Me, I'm not going to apologize for saying I ride the fucking wheels off my R6 around my canyon roads, because I've done it since I was 15 and a half with a permit, let's say 16 years old. You you have a sickness. You're not entirely healthy. I think you have a problem.
Well, I think there's nobody that would doubt that. certainly people of your and mine ilk, and perhaps even without a doubt, yours more, because I think everybody that even people that completely understand road racing, road racing as in far as short circuit, kind of look at the people that do things like the Isle of Macau as just a little bent. Now, let me throw my circumstance at you because it's similar but different. I used to tear up the canyons myself. There came a certain point over 10 years ago where I said to myself, I'm kind of getting outside of my comfort zone, and I basically said, well, what is my choice? I'm starting to worry about this, and perhaps it's because I was overriding myself. And I said, you know what? I basically hung up the canyons and went to the track, where I got enough of a jazz out of that to not feel bad because I didn't ride the street. But like you say, everybody is wired differently. And I am not one to have a opinion on saying, oh, you shouldn't do that, when I certainly know that I'd done it myself an awful lot in the past. And so I can leave it at that. People are different.
Well, I think that you just made another example of what I'm trying to preach tonight, which is that you did it on your own terms. You did it at your own speed. When you felt that you were going too fast on the cannons, you took it to the racetrack exclusively. You got to be in that mindset, and I think that we are all naturally inherent. I don't want to be one of these people that says, the television's going to make our children go out and crash on a canyon road because they saw dorky Tom Cruise doing a fake stunt with a machine gun doing a stoppie with a Triumph. You know, like,
no, dude, that happened.
he really did that, yeah. But we're a lot smarter than the people who are making this Hollywood stuff give us credit for. And I've been there, I've been in the trenches, I've been doing this a long time on the public roads, and I'm unique in that a lot of professional road racers don't ride on the street, because not only are they worth too much and their sponsors would frown on it, it's too dangerous. You know, it's stupid.
But I mean, okay, so okay, let's take it even further back though, Mark, because this is something that stuck in my head, and we're going to get shitloads of commentary about that, about this, and that's fine. I look back at where the railroads racers were testing back in the day, and this is not a new phenomenon, if you will. There is just a bit more of an anti-state thing going on, and the thing is a fair amount of our listeners are more mature, and they're kind of the cluck-cluck zone, if you will. Get off my lawn! But is that back in, you know, you look at these older movies and documentaries that were produced, and especially the stuff that's coming out of Ireland and whatnot, everybody trained on the roads. And I'm assuming that for the most part, you've still got guys that are training on the roads over there right now. Because, and I'm not advocating it by any means, I think it's a very exclusive thing, but it is going to happen. And I don't think anybody can point a finger and go, nah.
Well, can I say something?
You can say anything you want. I always say that.
I am not saying that you have to use a public road to train for motorcycle racing. It's just simply something that it happens to be that I would be riding on the roads regardless of whether I raced or not. I started racing after I did the roads. I only went racing to see how many guys I could beat on a racetrack, knowing that nobody could beat me on the public roads. So I'm a street guy first. I'm a street squid, complete squid, who went road racing. And, you know, we did okay. We did the AMA stuff. We got, 20 podiums, a race win, rode for some big teams. Great. Now we're doing the road races, real roads races, because it's sort of a natural place to end up in later on in the years. And I didn't make a bunch of money. I'm not a big marquee guy. I am not a famous marquee guy by any means, and nobody thinks I am. My only point is that I would be riding on the roads even if I was a fucking accountant. That's just me. What? Veronique says, what? Because she's an accountant.
Oh, bit of a slight. Go on.
But the thing is, it's kind of like, it's the one of the reasons why I really hate smoking cigarettes is it takes you outside for a breath of fresh air to see the trees and the sky. And I'm like, well, if you stop smoking, you stop going outside of the house, or you start going outside of your working place and have a chat with some cool people and relax for a bit and smell the breeze and the flowers and, you know, see the blue sky and the puffy white clouds. Riding on a canyon road for me since birth, it seems like, is about getting out of the house as well. And also, and I'm just being honest, and I don't pretend to think that everybody gives a shit about what I have to say, but the point, you've asked me the question, and the answer is, when you can do something well, like you're a bird, it flies. When you're a swim, it fishes. And somebody like, when you're born to manipulate a machine like this contraption that we've invented, which has two gyros and a fucking propellant and, you know, a chain that works a rear wheel. Guys like you and me that get it, and to change the geometry of the bike and to flip it from side to side, the physics involved, to also put some horses in the distance and the ocean in the distance and a beautiful black tarmac with this textures of brown rocks, and I sound like a freaking idiot, but it's a beautiful thing to do in your life and to completely absorb, and it's something I have to do, and if I get killed doing it, which I can easily be doing, I mean, I am not infallible. I can make a mistake. A car could pull out. Just today, I was training on the roads, come around the corner, and somebody was turning around, not only a big SUV, extended cab, 250 Super Duty, it had a big U-Haul trailer behind it, which was two axle. He was in the middle of the fucking road when I come around the corner, and I didn't get angry. I didn't honk the horn. I just slow down and wave to the guy and says, hey, you're trying to turn the thing around. You know, it's not your fault that I'm coming around the corner. But you got to be smart, Jim. You're talking, you know, if we're talking about street riders, we're talking about all of us trying to stay alive doing the sport that we love. You got to use your head. When you get into some homes, when you get into something where there's driveways, slow down and respect the neighborhood. You know, you don't want to piss people off about our sport. You want people to embrace us. And when you pass somebody on a double yellow line, because there's no way you're sitting behind a car at 35 miles an hour for more than 7 seconds, you go by across a double yellow line, wave to them, just a quick little wave, and say, I respect you. You know, I want you to understand that I'm not trying to be a complete prick here. I just, there's no way in hell I'm going to sit behind you. And they realize that. My only point is, if you get out beyond the houses and it's just you and the road, don't be brainwashed and think that there's some rules. There are no rules. Go fuck yourself. You know, there's no fucking rules. It's you and the racetrack. It's a human experience. You're alive. You know, we were lucky enough for somebody to put these little tiny rocks together by glue and cut a hole on the side of a mountain that's this gorgeous meadow, and you have a flat surface, and somebody's invented another black rolling tire that's good enough to grip it. How could not all of us spend almost our entire life doing this activity? To me, it blows my mind that anyone would question, you know, the sanity behind it. It's the most beautiful thing you could do with your life, in my opinion. That's just one opinion.
Is it better than sex?
No. No, sex is the most amazing thing. Second is the bike.
Good answer, Mark.
Ask Ross.
You know, trying to get an interview with him is like trying to dig for gold in a vacuum. The man is impossible. Someday, that is going to be my coup de grace. I will retire from this, my shitty little world of podcasting. That being said, the show continues to go places, and frankly, you've been a great help to that, and you're well loved. All right, thank you for all that, and I have no doubt that we're going to get a ton of feedback, and that's totally fine. And I will forward on to you anything, or if you folks out there in MotoGPOD land want to bring something up, either on the fan page or whatnot, maybe Mark will see fit to answer or not. You may channel it through me.
Hey, can I say one more thing? Because I don't know if I've actually put the point as clear as I meant to. Can I say one more thing?
Dude.
Everybody rides within their own limits. In other words, if you you may think that it's all relative. It's all relative to each other, to ourselves. I could be going, you know, fucking 150% through a canyon road. You could be going 35% through the road, but it still feels the same to you. You don't have to be the best guy on the mountain to get the same level of enjoyment out of it. it's all relative to us as individuals. I wanted to make sure that I made that clear, that we all feel the same thing, even at varying speeds and experience levels.
There's no doubt. There's
Mark Miller, everybody. I just wanted to hit that home because it's important.
No, and I agree. And, you know, frankly, we could belabor this thing for a while. And what I was trying to do was kind of, even though I think along your lines, I also understand where people are coming from, but I also have a bit of recalcitrance at people that are kind of freaking out. Or nobody was, frankly, was freaking out, because our listeners are more sophisticated than that. But there were some people that were kind of, anyway, you know what? I don't even want to go down this path.
Use your head. I'm not advocating going ripping through neighborhoods and being an idiot and being dangerous.
Do you know what's...
Once you get out in the middle of nowhere, which you have to be lucky enough to have access to that in your neighborhood, if you will, then fuck it. You know, like, don't be discourteous. Don't be dangerous. If there's driveways, not only are you endangering yourself, you're endangering people that might be pulling out of their driveway innocently enough to go to the supermarket with their kids in the car. You know, it's not about being a jerk. It's not about being fearless or an aggressive a-hole that you might see on the Batman movies. You know, like some weird, you know, other thing on MTV. It's not about that. You know, it's about being courteous and also enjoying our sport.
I grew up riding as a kid in the Abu Desert, dirt bikes. And so for there, it was that exact same feeling of freedom, because you basically had no fences, you had no rules, and it was go where you want, go as fast as you want, and any consequence was a result of your own actions. And that was a fantastic feeling. And actually, when I came around and started riding on the roads, it was being corralled like that. I was like, well, wait a minute, you know? And I kind of missed the dirt. Anyhow, moving on. Mark, I do thank you for addressing that, and I look forward to seeing what people have to say, because I know that we're going to get some feedback, and that's very cool, because that's the kind of honesty that you have and that, frankly, I will let you put forth. I think it's totally valid to have a forum, and I love having you on the show, and people love to hear you, so if there is a question...
That is going to wear thin eventually, you know.
It may, but, you know, I'm going to let them tell me and instead... And okay, and so, well, we're going to be pushing the limits, because we're going to have you, as you and I discussed, we're going to have you, this is the pre-show for Macau. If I can, and you have the time, while you're at Macau, after you've had a day at least of practice, or whatever fits into your time schedule, we'll have a chat with you while you're there, as we did at the TT last year, and then I want to get kind of a wrap-up post-Macau.
Well, now that I have an iPad, which I got through a sponsor, I put a sticker on my helmet and the fucker sent me an iPad. And everyone's saying, oh, what's an iPad? Or some people are saying, I love my iPad, I want to have sex with my iPad. And other people are saying, what's the big deal? I got an iPad and I don't know what to do with it. I am one of the people who got an iPad and now I can't put it down. It's awesome, man. It's so fucking awesome. And I know it sounds silly coming from a grown man. With my iPad.
That is a bit queenie of you.
Oh yeah, you know, I'm a total fag. I mean, well, not a cigarette, but anyway, the point is that I'm going to take this to Macau, and we'll be able to plug in the microphone and do Skype. As long as I got wireless, which I have at the racetrack and I have at the hotel, you can go around the world with this little tiny flat thing and have every piece of knowledge that human beings have ever had on Wikipedia, etc. Like. It's right in the palm of your hand. It's a joke.
You know, I can't laugh at you and I can't mock you, because, frankly, we're a podcast that's mailed over the internet and it's not yet syndicated on regular radio. And so, frankly, if you're listening to it, you're automatically a geek. But
we're all geeks, dude. Come on. It's the coolest thing ever. We live in the Wild West, but it's a beautiful time to be alive, because we are at the very beginning of this new thing. You know, this viral... access to internet, this, man, you could put something on YouTube and if somebody likes it, you could have 20 million views in 8 days. You know, it could just kick. Everyone will share it. It's crazy.
Yeah, well, everybody's going to have their 15 minutes. I think Veronique's over there rolling her eyes.
Baby, are you alive?
Yes.
She's still pissed off about the accountant joke.
No.
Oh, okay. All right.
I think she's scheming to how to meet you sooner than later.
We'll talk. All right, so let's get more serious about Macau, because we are coming up on the timeline. First off, your bikes are already arranged for out there, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so, and that is not the Rico Penz team, but it is a BMW S1000RR that is well kitted up, and you have a German friend that lives there. I'm pulling this from memory, is that correct?
The gist of it is that the my team owner from the TT is also bringing a bike for me that will be operated and tuned by the Rico Penz team from the Bulldor. It's all the same Germans. I get my family back.
Okay.
After crashing my brains out and ruining their life, they're still willing. She's laughing. They're still willing to come out and support me. And I'm going to just do the best I can, dude. There's no expectation at this point. It's so competitive and it's so dangerous that I will ride the BMW as well as I can, and see where the chips fall. You never know. You know, I could be 18th, or I could be in a battle for third. You just can't. Guessing, dude, I love this expression where it says, talk is cheap, but in real roads racing, it's absolutely useless.
Yep.
There's no talking. You don't talk about racing between Armco walls. If it feels right, you go. If it doesn't feel right, you actually don't. So and I'll ride the bike. And it's fun to segue in the parlay in between this talk about riding on the public roads. Can you imagine if somebody says, I'll give you $30,000 to go ride professionally on the public roads against other knuckleheads that are stupid enough to do it just like you?
You know, your point is well taken. Shit.
It's a beautiful thing, right?
Let me ask you a question, because you and I have talked about this over and over at length, and kind of it's kind of something that people do wonder about, or at least people that are in the know enough, like me, to talk to people about. You getting paid?
I get paid enough. The economy has changed a lot from like 3 years ago, obviously, and the motorcycle industry has taken a big hit because it's recreational, and a lot of the wives will not allow the husbands to buy new helmets and jackets and motorcycles, so that trickles down to sponsorship.
Sure.
It's getting better. It's growing, and everybody took a hit across the board globally, and the motorcycle stuff is it wasn't hidden from that. So, but it has improved, and I think this next year will be better than it was this year, and I think even better than it was 3 years ago, from what I'm seeing. Now, it's all, you know, like I said, it's you try to get, if you can get a Monster or a Red Bull or a Rockstar, somebody could actually throw $45,000 up your ass for a lousy sticker on your helmet. You could get $90,000 for a sticker on your helmet.
So here is my question. I think you heard it in the last show. If you listened to the last show, did you?
I did.
There was a mention. Do you remember?
Tell me again.
Well, you know, we have stickers.
Would you like me to put a sticker up?
Honestly, I know that is extremely valuable real estate, but if I overnight you a sticker.
I leave at Thursday at 2 or 1 o'clock p.m. from L.A., from my house.
I will overnight you a sticker.
How big are they?
I've got multiple times. There's like a 2-inch by 4-inch. There's a 3-inch by 3-inch. They're pretty small.
Well, send me what you got, and I'll do my very best.
And I've got one that's got an American flag if you want to represent.
Well, I got an American flag already, but do ahead. Send me what you got. Hopefully they're not too expensive for you.
No worries, not at all. I'll send you at least two of each. I'll get your address.
You know I love your style. I love what you're doing, dude. You know.
I think it'd be badass. I want to see a picture of you at Macau, your shoulder with your nice new Joe Rocket leathers, by the way. Well plugged there, thank you, Jim.
We just don't tell Joe Rocket that they paid $20,000, but you got it.
Oh no, because that I just gave them $10,000 worth.
There you go.
See?
Hey, between you and me, Joe Rocket is actually a pretty decent value right now because Alpine Stars is now made in Malaysia and Vietnam, and so is Day and Easy, and their fucking retail prices are off the charts. They're not worth what they're selling the shit for. It's crap. And Joe Rocket is still being made in the exact same place, and the quality is all right. and the price has always been really kind of competitive, and I'm not giving you a fucking advertisement. I hate commercials. I don't watch TV. I don't do anything. I'm telling you a fact. Between you and me, the audience, if you will, the Joe Rocket shit has actually smoked the value of Alpine Stars and Dane Easy right now, because those two guys are living off their reputation. Valentino Rossi is not wearing what you can buy from Dane Easy.
Oh, dude.
And it's way overpriced by like 600%. Well, it should be $20 gloves, and they're trying to get $360 or some, I don't know what it was, $199 or something.
But true. Okay, so here is a bit of, and Mark, I hope you'll back me up on this. This is kind of a myth of motorcycle gear. The stuff that you see your heroes wearing, for the most part, and the guys I'm talking about, Mark, at the very top tier, is really not stuff that you can go out and buy off the shelf, for the most part. You know, granted, all the guys in the top tier are going to have custom suits. That's how the game works. You get measured out, unless you're somebody that's, you know, really average. Nothing off the rack is going to fit you well enough to compete at the top level. And especially when we're talking certain types of things and guys that are very particular about their gear. And helmets are probably another thing where you're talking about ultimate lightness. Now, that being said, you are on the middle-ish tier, if you will. Would you say that, Mark?
I don't understand what you mean by middle-ish.
You're a professional motorcycle road racer, but you're not at the GP level where those guys basically have somebody taking their letters when they get off their bike.
No, it's true.
Now, I'm not saying this at all. You definitely get a ton of attention from people like Joe Rocket that sponsor you, which is awesome, and your year is extremely hardcore, well-made, and probably made to measurements they've had from you before, right?
Yeah, I'm very, very, very lucky to... I could get as many as 4 custom suits made a year. I mean, that's not unusual. You know, if you do the Motosys electric bike, you do a TT bike and a Superbike TT bike, and then you go to fucking Macau, you know, that's 4 right there, and not to mention backups and a photo shoot for Sportrider magazine in Portugal for Michelin tires, whatever. So it's easy to get, you know, it's not unheard of that I'd get 4 suits.
Well, on top of that, they know that nobody else can wear your leathers because your legs are completely different.
They're really skinny, my legs here. Anyway, the quality of the Joe Rocket stuff is not what Rossi or Lorenzo or, you know, I saw a little bit with James Toseland. He was being really anal about, like, every gram of weight, and that's why nobody likes him, because he's kind of weird.
That's not the only reason.
Oh, really? So we won't go there. But anyway, the point is that the Rossi, of course, has handmade custom, you know, probably it's all kangaroo. I would think it's the thinnest kangaroo. It's I saw it might have been yesterday, Lorenzo took off his glove, and it's like a you know, it's less than 60 frames of video, where you just see a glimpse of him, the way the glove folded after it left his flesh. It wasn't what we have.
Yeah, it's like butter.
It was like butter. It was like this thin, amazing, it's probably abrasive resistant, treated with NASA, JPL Laboratories, you know, scuff. They've got stuff apparently where you can put a coating on something. If you hit the ground and it starts to heat up in an instant, less than a second, you know, like tenths of a second, it'll turn into hard. It'll actually become armor.
Yeah.
So anyway, but I have no clue because I'm pretending to be a professional motorcycle and you ask questions. I get custom suits from Joe Rocket. I have had custom racing suits from Alpine Stars. I've had custom racing suits from Dane Easy. And the Dane Easy people told me that it's exactly the same 5 individuals that makes Rossi's suits. Whether or not it's true or not, I don't know. But they said it was the fact. They said there's only 5 guys that have been working there for 45 years, and your suit will be made by the same 5 guys that makes Rossi suits. It's all very good when they're custom. What you buy at the showroom is not the same stuff. It's made in Vietnam. It's made in Malaysia. It's made in Pakistan. And it doesn't mean you shouldn't buy it. It means that you should buy it at a discount. Find it on sale. Because it's still going to crash once very well. If it crashes twice, you're fucked. Yeah. I'm just joking. But back in the day, Field Shear would crash once.
Yeah. Well, and there's plenty of brands on that way. All right. We're dwelling on gear, but one last tip of the cap to a very cool-looking suit from Joe Rocket and perhaps a City providing your boots and whoever else is providing the rest of your gear. It's very cool to have that kind of support, no doubt. All right, so back to Macau. I just kind of want to run down this timeline here. You're bolting out on late Thursday night, probably a red eye or something like that. You get there sometime during the weekend. We do have a day ahead you're going to jump, right?
Yeah, it's. I get there at 7:30 in the morning on Saturday. Saturday morning at 7:30 a.m. And then I got to take a fast ferry ride for 1 hour to Macau. And then they put me in a go-kart race for some function with a bunch of Asian photographers from their magazines and their, I don't know, television stations. I mean, it's a pretty organized deal. I've been chosen to go early.
Are you taking a video camera?
Nah, but they're talking about maybe shooting a documentary. Somebody was talking to me the other day about doing bringing a video camera and a crew to the TT for 11.
Okay.
To follow me around because I won't be doing it forever and they might be able to get an insider's scope look about it. But there won't be that at Macau this year. But yeah, we're going to go early. We're going to do some PR stuff. And I know I'm rambling on.
No, because in fact, I'm just as bad as you because I just thought of something that we talked about last time. And bless you, listeners, because I know that you'll allow us to do this. In the last call that we talked about, you were going to be hooking up with Mark Neal from Faster to shoot for him or with him. Did that happen?
Mark Neal, yeah. You say? Mark Neal is the most coolest guy you'll ever
meet. But you said you were going to shoot with him.
Yeah, he's been saying that all year. Unfortunately, Monster, you got to be careful about what you say because in my little shitty world of racing, I have friends that tell me things, and this is a little bit new to me to have somebody even listen to my dumbass ramble on. So I have to be careful, but I can tell you that when you deal with an energy drink, they have more money than they know how to spend because they're basically, they weren't that intelligent to begin with. And then they were given $1 billion and they're trying to give a little bit of money to save taxes and stuff. So the long story short is Mark Neal, who's a wonderful guy, has a beautiful family, and I love him to death. He has been put through the ringer. Yeah. By the money involved, by the people involved who hire certain people who may not have the vision and the performance, the competency. And poor Mark Neal has been only wanting to make the product the best he can make. Mark Neal has been promised things that weren't delivered in general terms. And at the very beginning of the process, he says, Miller, I'd love you to come out and help me. And then he says, I don't have a contract. I don't have any money. I don't even know how I'm going to get there. I'm going to dip into our savings or whatever to get there. And eventually it got slightly better, and then it totally tanked. And then it got slightly better again. Then it tanked again. So I'm sitting here going, I just want to be a part of it. I'd love to be somewhere involved with filming your next documentary. And at the end of the day, he got to go to the last two races.
Sweet.
And didn't.
Yeah, no, I did see a picture of him, I think, at Estoril. In the background, and I was like, okay, Mark's there, and I saw him with the camera. I think he was in Spee's pit.
Absolutely. I mean, and I'm sure it's going to be a fantastic documentary. I think it's got, what is it, Faster 2 or something? Or Faster?
We've had Faster, Fastest, or no,
Fastest.
Yeah. So,
yeah. He doesn't need me. I mean, I would love to have been a part, but he doesn't need me. He knows, but he's working on a shoestring. I mean, and God bless. I mean, the dude's trying really hard, and I think if he had gotten what he was promised early on, I would have been lucky enough to be a part of that.
Dude,
I'd lost out.
I'd be a grip for free.
That's what I told him. I said, I'll carry your baggage. You know, I don't give a shit.
Yeah, no, he's done the sport an honor. Okay, backtracking again. Macau, you show up on Saturday. You've got some promotional stuff that the folks there want you to do. You're going to do a kart race, and then you've got basically, how do you, you should be careful answering this as well. What are you going to do for a whole week there before you kind of get ready to hop on the bike?
I will try very hard not to buy women.
I knew that was coming.
Babe, she smacked me on the back of the head. She's delivering my my vodka cranberry. Give me a kiss. You know I'm kidding. I will probably be in the gym. I'm going to go to church. I'm going to probably help the orphans. I have a few days alone before Paul Shoesmith, who is Jamie Witten's good buddy. He's going to show up a couple days later, and then I'll show him around. David Johnson, who's another Australian who races in BSB in the Evo class, who I helped as a mechanic one-off at the Ulster Grand Prix, busted my ass like I've never busted my ass before because I just wanted the experience. Actually, did like, ugh. Anyway, I'll never do it again.
Famous last words.
Well, mechanics get no credit. Like they just have to work their ass off, you know. But God bless them. Anyway, I will show Paul Shoesmith and David Johnson around a bit. Try to stay out of jail, and we might go to China for some shopping, you know, because those guys that have a job, unlike myself, like to buy fake Nikes and stuff. So we'll go show them around and watch as they'll buy some fake Rolexes and stuff. But then eventually, you know, it gets serious. It gets to be why you're there. And I honestly, Jim, I want to get into the gym and eat much less and try to drop a few kilos, a few pounds, just because, I mean, it's a week. Like, I'm not even on track till Thursday, I think. So you can change your body quite a bit from Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, on the track Thursday. I could easily lean up, and you know that it makes you feel healthier. It's not so much that a few pounds is going to make a big difference on the bike, but
do you know what? Feel
like you deserve it.
I'm laughing at you because I remember you giving me this whole line before Val d'Or, and then you said you went and did the test and you rode like shit. You said, "Okay, well, I'm going to go back to smoking cigarettes and drinking again."
I know, right? I resisted buying some cigarettes tonight. I haven't smoked for a week, and I'm not a smoker. Like, I can't even hear myself say this, but I have started to smoke a little bit because I've been hanging out in Europe. But I have a feeling as soon as I get to Asia, I'm going to be like, you know, buying cigarettes. But drugs are bad, as Mr. Mackey likes to say, as we all know. I will be involved in the Macau stuff. I mean, they tell me where to go. I don't mean to be anything but truthful, which is all I know is I don't want to miss my plane. Once I get there, they all tell me. They literally, you know, we talked about it being a Formula One environment. You get off the plane, they've got your little plaque, and they say, "Mr. Miller, come this way," and you find them, and they shake your hand. It's the same dude, like, every year, which is kind of cool because after a while, you're like, "What's up, dude? You're like, how you doing?" And they put you in a Toyota SUV, but they don't have them in the States. They're like this really plush. It's almost like something out of a movie where they'll have the dice and the little, you know, like it, the Asians are a little bit like Mexico.
Oh, yeah, no. I know exactly what you're talking about. Yep.
Even if it's clean bling, they'll have like a gold metallic, you know, SUV, Toyota, Lexus, fucking SUV, but then they've got the dice and the whole thing, and it's endless amounts of little tiny trinkets inside the truck. But anyway, they take you to the fucking thing, and they go blah, 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 blah. So this is my 10th time. I'd love to be more detailed and interesting, but at this point, you know, it's about kind of getting to the bike, and we'll survive. And I do want to be in the gym for the next 4 days. I'm going to bring the supplements and the proteins and the things, and I'll lean up a little bit extra more. You know, if you do it too early, you burn out. So I'm like Colin Edwards, I feel like, and I'm just old. Like, I just want to have fun and also kick some ass. You know, it'd be kind of nice to beat some guys.
No doubt. I mean, and frankly, your superbike work at the TT last year had to have been kind of unsatisfying too.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so
it's all good. I mean, it's all good. Like I said, there's actually Curtis Roberts once said to me, and this is a little bit of a private moment. He sat me on the couch and he says, "Look, it doesn't really in his experience, he says, it doesn't matter how hard you train per se. It's whether God, the universe is what he was saying, God, chooses for you. In other words, when I heard that, I felt like it's true. Like, it's what circumstance. There could be somebody that you think is unbeatable. Last year, John McGinnis, who's typically unbeatable, he faded. And I caught him and passed him. And later on, I saw him in the pits. I said, what the fuck happened? He says, this wasn't into it. Just didn't feel it.
It's my day.
Jeremy Toy, who's like a UFC fighter, you know, he's a big, strapping, tattooed, lean, amazing individual. He's a great human being, but he's also very stocky and very, very muscular. And I caught him in the race near the end. I was catching him. And later on, I asked him, I said, what happened? And he's like, yeah, I got kind of, you know, I got burned out. Like, I got tired because I'm too bulky. Like, I'm too muscular. So there's no rules. When you get on that starting grid, you just kind of look at everybody ahead of you and just go, fuck you. You know, like, I don't give a fuck. I'll do whatever I can. If I get my ass kicked, as long as I don't kill myself, I'm happy. If I kick your ass, I'm even more happy because I can sit here cavalier with a couple drinks because you and I, Jim, always drink when we talk to each other. And this is no exception, but when you get on the grid, and it's something about watching Simicelli the last two weekends, who's shown his real personality. He reminds me of Aaron Yates. You know, watching Aaron Yates. Aaron Yates is my hero. You know, in modern times, the guy can't help himself. Even if he's winning the 600 race or the 750 race or the Formula Extreme race or the Superbike race, it doesn't matter if it's strategically proper to do so. He will light the tire up and burn the fucking tire off the rim because he can't help himself but have fun.
True story.
And Simicelli, I think, is a little bit like that, and it's so fun to watch. My only point is you can't help yourself. Once you put the visor down, like Scott Russell once said in my documentary that I may one day put out, everything changes. You know, you can talk before the race, you can talk well before the race, you can talk right up to about to start. It doesn't matter. Talk is not the point. You shut the visor, and a professional road racer is not a professional anymore, per se. They're an animal. Mm-hmm. Oh, they're going to chase the gazelle. They're going to become the instinct that is not only themselves, but their ancestors. And I know here I go off on a little tangent, but if you watch enough documentaries on the National Geographic, because Netflix has got $8 a month on ITV and fucking stop laughing. What's it called? What is the three? Sony PlayStation 3. You can watch a lot of documentaries now for $8 a month, unlimited. You watch enough of those things, and you realize that we are wired a certain way, and it's from our parents and our parents and our grandparents and our grandparents. A guy like Simoncelli or Aaron Yates or Rossi, there's a certain level of intelligence, but there's also this instinct to kill. There's an instinct to maim and to embarrass. And it's part of life, and I'm starting in my older age to realize that as a loving guy, as a very artistic, I love art, I love symphonies and operas like a fag, and museums and stuff, but there is a side of us that's also just as beautiful, which is to kill. And to kill is part of life, to survive. And I think these guys like Simicelli and Aaron Yates and Rossi, and Lorenzo for all that, and even Dovi. Man, Dovi's impressing me. I love Dovi this year. He's showing that he's not just another guy. He's trying really hard. They want to beat these guys. And when you get on the grid and you put the visor down, you will be that. You will become that. All the press is annoying. All the sound bites are annoying. You get sick of saying the same thing over and over again. You just want to get the fuck in your leathers and get on the bike. And especially if you have something to lose, which is your life or your health. You've got Armco lying at 170-mile-an-hour kinks at Macau. You will become who you are naturally inside as soon as it's like, yeah. You know what? I talked the talk, fine. I did the PR. I got the sponsorship. I got the Red Bull. I showed the stupid thing. You know, I took a drink. I played the game. All that gets thrown out the window because you have no choice. You become an animal when you flip that visor down. it becomes how talented you are, how hungry you are, the desire, your natural ability, and also a slight little bit of wanting to slay people. You want to beat the shit out of others. It's a competitive nature, and it's inherent in us in humans. Anyway, that's my latest.
Dude, no worries. For me at least, it was always my light switch from regular Joe normal to full race mode was the snick sound when my visor clicked into place. That snick was like ding. It was like, okay. I go around a warm-up lap and whatever. I'm still in kind of like, okay, all right, figuring things out, make sure everything's cool. But as soon as that visor snicked down, it was literally that snicking noise, and I can hear it right now in my head. and there are some neurons that go, whoa, wait a minute, okay, we're going the other direction now. I know exactly what you mean. You said it far more eloquently than I could. And I know you're going to listen back to that. You're going to want to listen back to that soon and go, what the fuck did I say?
Where was I when I
said that? No, that was good. And I think, frankly, a lot of people are going to take that to heart. It's a little bit of a look inside, and that's why I totally let you go. I'm like, I'm not interrupting.
It's the truth.
No, it is.
And we all have it. Like I said, it's relative. I mean, we all have it.
Yeah, and it's like we're not going to – but it's specific to motorcycles, folks. If we meet you on the street, we're not about to claw your eyes out.
You know what's super cool is somebody like Ben Spies and Tom Houseworth, his crew chief, who I know very well. They have this calmness. It's like they don't get emotional. They don't get excited. And how cool is that contrast to not only Rossi, who's the real deal, who's a clown from birth, he's a lovely, like, outgoing, eccentric character, to Lorenzo, who's more like Spies, who thinks he needs to be Rossi after he wins a race, and nobody's buying
it. You know what? I think he's actually got his own personality. You know, no matter who follows on the heels of Rossi's annex, everybody's going to say that he's imitating him, and especially if you're on the same team and you're hitting that top tier. And frankly, those two are in the snub business right now. It's like, in your face. No, in your face. And frankly, right now, and certainly for this season, Lorenzo's won that battle. I think Rossi's going to – everybody thinks that they kind of do these cutesy little things back and forth. None of that is real friendly stuff, even though it might look like it on the surface. There is some serious mind games going. People are like, Lorenzo isn't playing mind games. Oh, yes, he is. He's playing them just as hard, though not as professionally as much experience as Rossi is. That's why I'm really looking forward to next year. A lot of people don't like that crap. I love it. I love it.
You talking about the mind games or the after-the-race stuff you don't like?
No, I like it.
You like the after-the-race pageantry, the walking in the sand?
I like it from a... what are you really saying with that standpoint? I don't like it from a, ooh, boy, yay, clap, clap, clap. Okay. Because they're making a statement one way or another.
So what happened with the USGP when they started playing the Italian national anthem instead of the Spanish?
That was a plain old fuck up.
You think it was? Okay. But how poignant?
Well, sure. I mean, but see, the thing is, everybody is laser focused on what's going on at the time. And you catch everything. Shit happens all the time. But everybody, what are you paying attention to at the end of the race? Your eyes are during a race, and when you're watching a race, you've got on screen. You've got probably if you got five guys in a pack, or three guys in a pack, or two, or whatever. You as a racer, I think racers watch races much differently than probably regular folks do. Are you there? I think I've kind
of, I am okay. Here.
I think we watch races differently than just your general public do, because we actually probably watch ahead of whoever is leading more than most folks do, because they tend to watch the guy in back to see what he's going to do. Well, we're actually, for the racer, looking through the apex to see where they need to go, whether it's an offensive or defensive move, to try and see what they need to do. I know that whenever I'm watching onboard stuff, I'm essentially transported to the bike for the most part. And I find myself leaning all the way through a race if I see that kind of crap. And that's frankly what juices me up about watching races live, because if I don't see them live and I have to hear about it later from somebody, I'm like, ah, fuck, you know. That's my missed opportunity to actually live it for myself. Perhaps that's the retiree special.
No, it's you know, it's so cool is to just hear the bikes on board. You know, I'm not sure. Let me ask you a question. I'm not convinced that the horizontal camera on a gyro is an improvement. Although it's cool to see it, the option. I think I rather would have a fixed camera on board on the tail section, looking forward on the back of the riders, leathers. If it goes into the corners, I want to see the horizon change. I don't want to look like a car watching the bike lean over. What do you think?
Well, I think ideally what you would have is the view that we would have as a rider, which is as we're going through corners, we actually do that gyroscopic correction ourselves to try and keep the horizon somewhat level, but it's never level, especially with massive lean angles. But you're constantly making that correction through the corner. But the problem is if you affix something to a helmet, which is neat, but there's A, vibration, and B, these guys are looking through the corners at like a, you know, a 90-degree angle, and that's not good for TV. Well, you know what I mean? You're not going to be looking at the guy in front of you. You're looking so far and you're looking so far around him that that doesn't even matter. You're not looking at the battle. So,
how lucky are we to be alive to even have this chat in such a manner? I mean, come on.
True. Well, and in fact, you know, what's kind of amazing is you and I are souls of a kindred spirit. We've never met each other. But, you know, I have a feeling once we sit down and talk face to face and have a beer, it's going to be like, ah, yeah, whatever, I already know you. So,
no shit, right?
Yeah, times are changed. And, you know, Veronique will tell me all about you anyway, so.
Ooh, she'll say.
No.
He said he's going to steal you away from me.
No.
No. No, you still have months left here, don't you?
Do you have months left here?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Well, I'll wait.
What time do you leave? She's so embarrassed because every time she hears her voice back on the internet, she's like, oh, my God, oh, my God, come here.
Very,
this chick.
Step up to the mic, dear.
Sweetie, come hello.
Hey, Jim.
Trust me, we want to hear your voice because we're all a bunch of perverts that ride motorcycles.
Veronique, if you don't like it, you tell me and I will take it out. I can edit out. Hello, Veronique. How are you?
Please do.
You are way too embarrassed. Do you know what? I used to hate my own voice, too. I will edit some of this out. Listen,
I didn't want to say anything.
Yeah, when you feel comfortable coming on the show, or being a sidekick, if you will, you let us know, and we would let...
So ask her a question, Jim. Can you give her, like, 2 minutes?
I totally could. Okay, and this would be easy. Are you close enough so I can hear you?
How's that?
That's good.
Okay.
I'll start with something simple, and I'll ask you something hard, because that's always the funnest way to do it. Okay. Where did you meet Mark?
Oh, I met Mark on the Isle of Man, in Colors. It's, oh my God, please, I can't do this.
Yeah, you can, because you're just talking to me.
Okay, I'm talking to you, Jim. So, yeah, I met Mark on the Isle of Man in 2006.
You guys are being goobers. I can tell.
You know
it. Needs to go for a wee-wee. Okay. But anyway, you can edit that, so that's fine. Yeah, so we met on the island in a place called Colors. It's where everyone ends up in a nightlife.
Oh, yeah, Quarter.
Yeah.
In Quarters. Yeah. Okay. That is a rather infamous bar, is it not? That is a rather famous bar for...
Yes. Yes, everyone seems to end up there. Although it's not the coolest place on the island, but everyone seems to think it is. You know, the people that come, the people that don't know the island, they come here and they think that Colors is the place, and all the paddock end up there. And actually, it's a good atmosphere during TT, but outside TT, it's not that great.
Okay, so, and you lived on the island for how long now?
9 years.
9 years, really? Without giving too much away, where do you live, Douglas or?
Yes, Douglas. I can't see the sea from my bed. Oh,
very nice, very nice. And the weather there is shit, isn't it?
Oh my god, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
The good time, usually during TT, the weather tends to be quite good, so it's a good time to come and visit the island.
How does a lovely French girl turn into an accountant and land on the Isle of Man, besides the fact that it's a tax haven?
Oh, how did I do that? I just wanted to progress quickly, so I just looked at, I've got a master's in international business, so I looked at something that I could, where I could progress quickly, you know, in the business environment, and SCCA was a good qualification, so I went for that. Oh, ACCA Chartered Certified Accountant.
Okay.
So I just wanted to progress quickly, and it worked.
And so obviously you saw the guys racing. Did you have an interest in racing before you started following the TT at the app?
Not at all. I actually had never been on a bike until I met Mark Ring. Never. And now I'm going on the back of the bike.
Really?
In the
back of the R6?
Yes, in the canyon. And I'm like, it's like you've got that calmness inside you, you know? And it's just like, I just have to follow his body, you know? Left, right, and it's not relaxing. It's more like being on a roller coaster.
Isn't this the same motorcycle that the handlebars fell off of?
yes, we've got new handlebars now, so that's okay.
All right, so let me ask you a question, and this is the hard question. I gave you a bunch of easy ones. When Mark is racing, and when he is in a hard race, or when he is in doing a lap at the aisle, and you don't hear any information back from him, or you hear of an accident on the island, what are the feelings that go through your mind?
It's awful. Awful, like you feel sick. When he goes off, I don't know, inside I've got the feeling that he's going to be fine. But when you're actually there on the grandstand, and like this year it happened, you know, when Guy Martin crashed, like they didn't give you any information for about 10-15 minutes, and you just know that the race has stopped completely, so it's really bad. And it's just like, I don't know, it's just nerve-wracking. And then suddenly they give you the number, like, this is number 8, and, like, kind of a relief. And then they say, the guy is safe, and it's like, wow, everyone can breathe again, and you can't wait to see them coming back, you know, in the paddock and see them in the flesh. So I don't know, it's like you stop breathing until you get, you know, an answer back from them.
And how did you end up at Macau the first time?
Mark invited me, he asked me, if I fancy to come along, and I did.
Okay, all right, so.
I love the adventure, so it's a different place, it's more of a mind place, you know, if you want my idea.
All right, well, your audition is over, you've done very well, we'll give you a call back and let you know if you have one on American Idol.
Very funny. Haha.
Thank you, Veronique.
Pleasure. Sorry about that.
It will be much easier next time, won't it?
Oh, I hope so.
And happy birthday again.
Oh, thank you. That was cool. Yeah.
She's.
I'm red like a radish.
At least I got to go take a piss.
That was pretty much, I kind of had a feeling, and frankly, I think it's my turn.
Yeah, go on, man.
Well, listen, I think we've covered everything up until, and I will edit some of this out, although certainly, Veronique, you will get a little bit of a cameo this week. Is there anything else that you want to say about kind of leading up, we'll kind of roll back in here. Give me an idea as you work to slim down and you're taking care of your training and you're getting out of the bullshit media activities as you start to approach day one. Where you're actually getting on, well, I'm assuming there's a day zero where you meet up with the team, you kind of look the bike over, get everything set up, your ergonomics and whatever there, work things out. What happens as you're starting to prepare for your first practice, especially, and this is something I've always wondered, Mark, because I've never actually seen a Macau. You never get to see practices over here in the States. I have to bootleg whatever to actually get the race because it never shows here. What do you do when there's weather? Do the bikes go out?
No. They won't race on the wet between the Armco.
Bikes and cars, or just bikes?
Not sure about cars. Yeah, actually, yeah, you know what? There's two types of approaches to this racing stuff. One, you either gotta fire up your ass and you train your ass off, and you show up and you're all like thinking you're prepared, or you relax and you not relax. You're lazy and you don't do the work. And you try to fall back on your natural talent. This particular race, after the 24-hour that we've spoke about, I haven't trained enough. So I am not in the shape that I could be, but I'm in no way fat, or I'm still lean, I'm limber. You can overtrain very, very easily. You can become stiff, you can become sore. You've got injuries from even training, even in the gym. You can pull stuff, you can rotate your fucking whatever, your knees are not right. So anyway, just to be completely honest, it's a mystery how I will do this year at the Macau Grand Prix, because you're talking to me, so I'm going to give you my forecast. I have no clue how I will finish the 2010, my 10th time Macau try. All I know is the bike will be fast in a straight line. We'll get it going. I'm on Dunlops. I'm arrogant. I'm confident. I don't give a fuck. After watching Simicelli, it's kind of inspired me to...
I was going to ask you, so... You head into it like this, and you had a fair amount of bravado going into the aisle last year, and that was exactly why I want to talk to you the same way this year. If I talked to you, you know, a day or two, or just say a day of practice under your belt, as long as it's dry weather or good weather and good conditions and the bike set up properly, do you really think you'll have a mark on it then as to where you'll finish?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that that's something that you can do. I don't think that the result, you know, you can see Lorenzo or Casey Stoner or what some of these guys, Dovizioso, Dovi, he'll qualify seventh. And, you know, the guy's in the hunt for fourth. I mean, whatever. I mean, you just go with the flow. And the number one thing is to be safe. And the secondary thing is to let your natural ability take over your natural fitness. And I've been doing this long enough to where we can talk because I haven't been there yet. I can talk about the street stuff because I've been doing it today, but when we talk in China, it's after the 13-hour flight, it's after the fast ferry ride, it's after I get in the fucking hotel, it's after I see the track, I do the kart race, I do the PR bullshit, and I do the charity auction, and I'll be in that mix. Ask me again, and it'll be a hell of a lot more accurate. I can only tell you that there's a couple guys missing this year. There's who's missing? Connor Cummings, Ian Hutchinson, and Steve Plater are all out on injury.
Yeah, and frankly, with the what Hutchie did this last year, not having them there, and Plater too. And Connor, I mean, all three of those guys would have been threats there. So,
how old are you, Jim?
I'm older than you. I'm 48.
Oh, you're 48? How much? Oh, you are older than me, barely. No.
Well, thank you, but I'm still a teen.
The reason why I ask is
you just completely screwed up my chance with Vera.
That's not true. That's not true. Beautiful young women don't like anyone near their age. I mean, I'm finding more and more. And I don't know shit, to be honest. But listen, the reason why I asked is because... I don't know. It's something to do with the fact that I'm actually kind of hungry because I wasn't invited officially and I had to backdoor the shit like we talked before.
Well, you slacked for a while.
Yeah, I was getting late. I was traveling and going to museums. But now that I'm there, I got to be honest, because I know this is the kind of the fun nuggets that you and I share together. When I show up at the Hong Kong airport, I'm going to be grinning because I shouldn't be there.
And yet another fantastic interview with Mark. He's, if he was born to ride, in second place, he was born to talk about riding. He's, I could, honestly, I could listen to him all day, and I still have this, this acorn of an idea of getting Mark, one of us as a sort of, you know, MC, and James Whittam in the same room, and just let them go. And you're probably going to get a couple of months worth of podcasts out of it.
No doubt.
Brilliant stuff. I mean, the Macau stuff is fascinating. And, you know, despite my reservations, I have to take my hat off to Mark's, not justification, but his explanation of why he rides the way he rides in the circumstances he rides. And say, well, as we discussed earlier, Jim, you know, he's not apologizing for anything. He's just saying, this is how it is. I could listen to him all day.
Yeah, no doubt. And I did FedEx the stickers off to him first thing this morning. So we'll have to see what we end up with. But at least a little bit of the show will be in Macau. Very cool. A great and yet another long show, Martin. We're going to be... Yeah. What, 2.5 hours minimum? So I guess, Alex, this one's for you.
Yeah. And if Nick gets held up by grounded submarines on his ferry crossing, then at least he'll have something to listen to.
Yeah, all of you out there, I hope you had the batteries charged on your recording devices. And we will probably be talking to you soon, but let's finish some of this out. There's a few more things to talk about.
Yeah, well, we will come back in the next week or two and go through the Moto2 riders and teams list for next year, as that's pretty much finalised now. And we did see today, or I noted just checking Twitter, that Eugene Laverty is off to Valencia today for testing. Now, I can't find information on whether that's a full World Superbike test or a team test. So
there's going to be a bunch of World Superbike guys who are going to be testing at Valencia come to tomorrow.
Thursday.
Yeah, being Thursday. The day before.
Today.
We're doing our time travel thing again. But, we won't have any information on that in this particular show, but you guys will know about it. And once again, we'll be talking about it on the Facebook fan page. And so, yeah, it's going to be very cool. You know, so it's never done, Martin.
No, absolutely.
You're in too deep now.
The only downside now, and it is always that, February before the next MotoGP test. But at least we're a couple of weeks earlier on the start of the season, so we've got March 20th for Qatar, and of course World Superbikes will start traditionally. They have their season opener earlier still, and then take a break for a month or so.
Yep.
So it's not too bad, but oh, come on. all I've got to look forward to is birthday, Christmas, and a wedding.
Well, careful how you say that.
Yeah. What I meant to say was, thank goodness I've got birthday, Christmas, and my wedding to look forward to before the season starts again.
And when is your birthday, Mark?
25th of this month.
Ah, well then, I just remind our folks out there that would like to send Martin some birthday greetings. Feel free. He's going to be 4D, right?
45.
You'll never catch me, Martin.
I'm having a damn good go. And Big John Hart, his birthday is, I believe, the 21st. So just before he misses being a Sagittarian, which is obviously the best star sign to be. I have no idea what it means. Something to do with a goat that shoots bows and arrows. I'm not sure.
I think this is where we've realized that it's late for me and early for you.
Yeah.
All right, folks out there, thanks so much for bearing with. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'm sure you did. Cards and letters coming. Feel free to send information to us at the contact form at the MotoGP MotoPod.com website or the MotoPodcast.com website, which I think works at this point. If not, we'll make sure it gets working very quickly. But otherwise, you can also always get us through the Facebook page and anywhere else that you figure out how to do it. We're very accessible and always happy to talk to you.
And don't forget, anybody with top tips for where to stay, how to get to the various rounds, particularly Qatar, because it is a bit, it's a bit of a different environment, or any of the long-haul ones, do please send them in. We can pass those on to Stephen Schmidt, and also we'll talk about them.
Yeah, and on top of that, I am taking our new logo and have some kitschy ideas for our old one. And I am putting that together on looking for I'm going to put that together on T-shirts, but not, I don't want to do it on the cheesy T-shirts that are out there, some of these very thin ones that are just kind of eh. You've got one of the good ones, Martin. I think you've got like a Hanes, and it's a nice solid cotton. So I'm looking for some place that is not too expensive, yet I can actually put together a nice screened-on print, not the iron-on one. So I don't necessarily need suggestions, folks. Thanks. I know. Well, if you want to send something in, or if you are a screen printer and would like to talk to us about potentially putting together the shirts, if you can also do fulfillment, that would be great. On that note, made the long show longer. as Mark, Mark's, I loved saying that Mark has to make a long story short, too late.
Yeah.
Wrap it up with that. Thanks, and we will talk to you all again next week. Cheers, Martin.
Cheers, Jim. Good night, folks.